The woman fell directly in front of the Duke's carriage, and for one terrible second, the four horses seemed certain to trample the life out of her. Hold! Sebastian Vale's command struck the rainy afternoon like a pistol shot. The coachman hauled hard upon the reins, iron shoes scraped against the muddy road, wheels lurched, leather traces snapped taut, and the great black carriage bearing the crest of Bellemare stopped less than 6 feet from the pale figure lying in the ruts. Hampshire, England, 1854, had seen many miserable afternoons. This one seemed made of cold mist, brown hedgerows, and the kind of rain that did not fall heavily enough to be called a storm, yet soaked everything it touched with patient cruelty. His Grace, Sebastian Vale, Duke of Bellemare, had been returning to Alderwick Park after a fruitless call upon a neighboring magistrate, already irritated by weak tea, evasive answers, and the endless small deceits of county society. He had expected nothing more dramatic than wet roads and a delayed dinner. He had not expected a woman to stagger from the roadside hedge, lift one hand as if trying to stop a world that had already passed her by, and collapse before his forces. "Your Grace?" the footman called from behind, his voice thin with alarm. Sebastian was already opening the carriage door. "Stay with the horses. But Your Grace, she may be a trick. Then it is a poorly chosen one." Sebastian stepped down into mud that took the shine from his boot in an instant. The rain touched his hat brim and the shoulders of his dark traveling coat. He did not look back to see whether the servants approved. Approval had never guided him, and hesitation in matters of human distress had always seemed to him the ugliest form of cowardice. The woman lay on her side, one cheek against the road, her gloved hand curled near her breast. Her bonnet had slipped loose, showing dark hair pinned badly beneath it, as though she had dressed in haste or exhaustion. Her gown was grey wool, plain and damp at the hem, too worn for a gentlewoman and too carefully mended for a careless servant. One sleeve had been repaired in tiny stitches by someone with patience, pride, and very little money. She could not have been more than 25, though hunger and strain had drawn shadows beneath her eyes that made her seem older at first glance. Sebastian crouched beside her. "Madam," no answer. He removed one glove and placed two fingers lightly against her wrist. A pulse fluttered there, weak but present. Her skin was cold enough to startle him. Beneath the grime of the road and the rain, there was nothing coarse in her face. Her features were fine, her mouth pale, her lashes dark against her cheeks. She looked not like a woman who had chosen the open road, but like one who had been driven toward it until even fear could not keep her standing. "Is she alive?" the coachman called. "Yes." Sebastian slid one arm beneath her shoulders and the other beneath her knees. "Open the door." The footman jumped down at once, his uncertainty overcome by long training. "Your Grace, should we not send ahead? There may be an inn half a mile back. There is Alderwick Park 2 miles ahead. But if she is not respectable..." Sebastian looked at him once. The footman stopped speaking. Respectability, in Sebastian's experience, was most often a cloak worn by those who could afford better cloth. The woman weighed almost nothing when he lifted her. That troubled him more than the mud on her gown or the cut of her bonnet. Her head fell against his shoulder with a helplessness that made something old and guarded in him tighten. A faint scent of rain, lavender soap, and exhaustion clung to her. As he carried her to the carriage, one of her hands moved weakly against his coat. Not a grasp, not a plea. Only the instinctive motion of someone who had learned not to expect rescue, even when arms had already gathered her from the ground. "You are safe," he said, though he did not know if she could hear him. Her lips parted. The sound that escaped was barely a breath. "No," Sebastian stilled. "No what?" Her brow tightened, as though some terror pursued her through unconsciousness. "Do not send me back." The words were so faint the rain nearly swallowed them. Then she went limp again. The footman's face had gone pale. Sebastian carried her into the carriage and settled her upon the opposite seat. Removing his traveling cloak and placing it over her with more care than he would have expected from himself that morning. He had been accused of many things in his 37 years. Coldness, pride, ruthlessness, an unforgiving memory, excessive command. None of those accusations had ever wounded him, largely because most were true. Yet, as he sat across from the unconscious stranger and watched the tremor in her gloved fingers, he felt something sharper than curiosity. He felt anger, though he did not yet know where to aim it. "Drive to Alderwick Park," he ordered. At once, the carriage jolted forward. The woman shifted with the motion, and Sebastian reached across without thinking to steady her shoulder before she struck the panel. She was soaked through. Her bonnet strings had tangled at her throat, and he loosened them with restrained precision, careful not to touch more than necessary. That was when he saw the chain. It lay half hidden beneath the collar of her gown, thin and darkened with age. Not the sort of ornament a woman in her condition would wear, unless it mattered more than food. At the end of it, tucked under damp fabric, was a small ivory locket. The surface had cracked across the center like ice under pressure. Sebastian did not open it. Not then. A gentleman did not search an unconscious woman for secrets. Yet his eyes remained on it longer than they should have. The locket was too fine for the gown, too old to be a trinket bought in a village shop, too cherished to be accidental. The woman stirred again as the carriage turned between the stone pillars of Alderwick Park. She did not wake, but her hand rose weakly to her throat, seeking the locket, even in darkness. When her fingers found it, they closed around it with desperate force. Sebastian watched the movement, and the anger in him settled into purpose. Whoever she was, someone had taught her that one small object was all she could afford to lose. Alderwick Park received them with the grave astonishment of a great house interrupted by scandal. The butler, Mr. Harrow, opened the door before the carriage had fully stopped, his expression smooth until he saw the Duke step down, carrying a mud-stained woman wrapped in his own cloak. Behind him, two footmen froze. A housemaid gasped and then remembered herself. "Send for Mr. Larkin," Sebastian said. Immediately, Mr. Harrow recovered at once. "The apothecary, Your Grace, and the physician from Alresford, if he can be fetched within the hour. Have the blue guest chamber prepared, hot bricks, clean linen, broth, and a fire. Mrs. Vale is not in residence, so send for Lady Beatrice Anstruther. I require a proper chaperone in the house before nightfall." "Yes, Your Grace." The butler hesitated only once. "May I ask the lady's name?" Sebastian looked down at the face against his shoulder. "Not yet." He carried her up the main staircase rather than the servant's stair. He saw the glance one footman exchanged with another, quick as a spark and twice as revealing. By nightfall, half the household would have stitched a dozen explanations around this woman. By morning, if he handled it badly, the county would do the same. He had no patience for gossip, but he understood its appetite. A nameless woman carried into a duke's house could be ruined without waking. He would not permit that. The blue guest chamber overlooked the east lawn, its curtains drawn against the gray afternoon. A fire was lit quickly. The housekeeper, Mrs. Pym, arrived with smelling salts, blankets, and the sober competence of a woman who had managed emergencies without ever allowing the silver to go unpolished. "Poor thing," she murmured before she could stop herself. Sebastian heard the pity and disliked it, not because it was cruel, but because it was small. "She is a guest in this house," he said. "She will be spoken of as one." Mrs. Pym lowered her eyes. "Of course, Your Grace." He set the woman upon the bed and stepped back as the housekeeper and maid began to remove the wet cloak from around her. He turned away, offering privacy, but the movement of the cracked locket caught his eye again, as it slid free from her collar and rested against the hollow of her throat. The maid reached to move it aside. The woman's eyes flew open. They were gray. Not dull gray, but storm gray, startled and alive with terror. Her hand clamped over the locket. "No," the maid jerked back. "I beg your pardon, miss." The woman tried to sit up, failed, and stared at the room as if every object in it were a threat. Her gaze found Sebastian. Fear passed over her face, then calculation, then a fragile attempt at composure that struck him harder than tears would have. She was frightened enough to shake, yet she still tried to arrange her dignity around herself, like a torn shawl. "Where am I?" she asked. Her voice was hoarse, but the accent beneath it was educated. Not polished by imitation, formed by childhood. Alderwick Park, Sebastian said from a careful distance. You fell before my carriage. I brought you inside. Her fingers tightened over the locket. I should not be here. At present you should not be standing. I must go. You fainted in the road. I know. The admission cost her something. Her lashes lowered. I am sorry for the trouble. Sorry. Not frightened. Not grateful. Sorry. As though collapsing from exhaustion were a breach of etiquette. Sebastian felt the old anger stir again. What is your name? She paused one heartbeat too long. Mary Fenn. Miss Fenn, he said, though the name did not sit naturally upon her. No one will send you anywhere tonight. Her eyes rose to his face. You cannot promise that. In my own house I can promise a great deal. That should have reassured her. Instead, her gaze flicked toward the door, the windows, the bell pull. Every possible exit, and every possible trap. Mr. Larkin arrived before Sebastian could ask more, and propriety required him to withdraw to the corridor, while the apothecary and Mrs. Pym attended her. He stood outside the chamber door, listening to the low murmur of voices, the crackle of the fire, and once, very faintly, the woman saying, "Please, do not take it, the locket." When Mrs. Pym emerged a few minutes later, she held it in her palm. She grew distressed when I tried to loosen the chain, Your Grace. It is caught in the fabric. Mr. Larkin asked that it be removed before she rests, lest it trouble her breathing. She fainted again. Sebastian took the locket because Mrs. Pym offered it, and because the woman inside could not defend it herself. The ivory was warm from her skin. A crack ran through the painted surface, obscuring what might once have been a tiny spray of violets. He meant only to ensure the clasp had not broken. He meant to have Mrs. Pym return it at once. But the hinge gave beneath his thumb, and the locket opened. Inside, beneath a lock of dark baby hair faded brown with time, were three engraved words, Marianne Fairholt. The corridor seemed to go very still. Even the rain against the windows lost sound. Sebastian did not move. He knew that name, not as one knows a passing acquaintance or a family mentioned in a newspaper. He knew it from his mother's letters, from a black-edged note kept in her escritoire, from a sorrow she had carried quietly after the death of an old friend. Little Marianne Fairholt, lost after the fever. Little Marianne, whose mother had begged someone to watch over her if anything happened. Little Marianne, buried in memory 12 years ago. Behind the closed door, the woman who called herself Mary Fenn slept like someone who had run until her body failed. In Sebastian's hand lay the name of a dead child. He closed the locket with great care. Mrs. Pym, he said softly. Yes, Your Grace. No one outside this house is to hear of the lady in the blue chamber. The housekeeper studied his face and lost a shade of color. Of course, Sebastian looked at the closed door. His voice, when he spoke again, was low enough that only the rain and the old walls heard him clearly. Marianne Fairholt was buried in memory 12 years ago. By the time the physician from Alresford arrived, the woman in the blue chamber had already awakened twice, and both times she had reached for the cracked ivory locket, before she seemed to remember her own breath. Mr. Larkin, the apothecary, had left powders for weakness and a sharp little lecture about warmth, broth and rest, but Sebastian trusted the man only as far as his plainness extended. The physician, Dr. Merriweather, was older, slower, and less easily impressed by rank. He examined the patient with Mrs. Pym present, asked a few questions, received almost no answers, and emerged from the chamber, with a grave mouth and rain still shining on the shoulders of his coat. She is not dying, Your Grace, he said. That is the best of what I can tell you. Sebastian stood near the corridor window, the locket closed in his palm, and the worst? Exhaustion. Insufficient nourishment, for more than a day, perhaps longer. A chill beginning in the lungs if she is not kept warm. No obvious fever at present. No injury that requires alarm. The physician glanced toward the door, lowering his voice. She is more frightened than ill. And that is not a condition powders mend quickly. Did she give you a name? Mary Fenn. The name passed between them and fell flat upon the carpet. Sebastian looked down at the ivory locket. Did she say where she came from? Kersey House. Dr. Merriweather's brows drew together. As companion, so she says. She has the manners of a better station, and the eyes of someone who has been corrected too often for using them. It was not a medical observation, but it was a useful one. Sebastian had known men who noticed nothing beyond a pulse and a tongue. Dr. Merriweather had always been more difficult to dismiss. She asked to leave, the physician continued. She cannot. I told her as much. She did not seem reassured. No. Sebastian placed the locket on the small table beside the corridor lamp, then picked it up again almost at once. The act was foolish. He was not a man given to nervous handling of objects, yet this one held the weight of a question his house had not expected to receive. Marianne Fairholt. He had not thought of the Fairholt name in years. It belonged to a narrow lane of childhood memory, to his mother seated beside a writing desk, sealed with black wax. To one winter evening when he had found her weeping over a letter, and had been old enough to understand that adults could be helpless before grief. A child should not vanish twice, his mother had said then. Not knowing he stood behind the library door, he had never asked what she meant. A son learned early which sorrows belong to a mother alone. Now, in the blue chamber, a woman called Mary Fenn slept with that same lost child's name engraved against her heart. She may receive broth when she wakes, Dr. Merriweather said. Small amounts, no crowding. No questions unless she has strength for them. I do not crowd frightened women. The physician gave him a dry look. Dukes crowd rooms simply by entering them. Sebastian accepted the rebuke because it was accurate. Then I shall enter carefully. Half an hour later, when the rain had softened to a steady tapping on the glass, Mrs. Pym came to say the patient was awake and asking for the locket. Not asking exactly, pleading without the words, which Sebastian found worse. He entered the chamber only after Mrs. Pym announced him. The fire had begun to restore color to the room, though not yet to the woman propped against the pillows. Her hair had been loosened from its ruined pins and braided by the maid, which made her face look younger and more exposed. She had refused a nightdress from the house, Mrs. Pym had whispered, until convinced her own damp gown would make her worse. Now she wore a plain white wrapper, too large in the shoulders, and held the coverlet as if it were armor. Sebastian stopped several paces from the bed. Miss Fenn. Her gaze went at once to his hand. You have it. He opened his palm. The locket lay there, dull ivory crossed by its fine dark crack. Mrs. Pym removed it because the chain was caught in your gown. No one intended to keep it from you. Her throat moved. May I have it? He walked to the bedside table and placed it there. Near enough for her to reach, but not so near that he must stand over her. She seized it with both hands and shut her eyes for one brief, fiercely private moment. Only when the chain was wrapped around her fingers did she breathe again. Thank you, she said. The words were proper. The relief beneath them was not. It matters to you. It is mine. I did not say otherwise. Her eyes opened, gray. Clearer now, but guarded. People often say otherwise before they take what belongs to someone. That sounded less like complaint than experience. Sebastian drew a chair closer to the fire. Not the bed, and sat so she did not have to look upward at him. Dr. Merriweather says you require rest, warmth, and food. You will have all three here. Her fingers tightened on the locket. I cannot remain. You said that before. Then I was sensible before. You fainted in the road within 2 miles of my gates. I know what I did. Shame touched her face. She tried to lower her chin. Then corrected herself and lifted it again. That small act held more dignity than a dozen practiced curtsies. I am sorry to have caused inconvenience, Your Grace. A woman half frozen in the road is not an inconvenience. It depends upon who finds her. In this case it does not. She studied him, and he saw the effort behind it. She was measuring tone, distance, danger. You are the Duke of Belmere, yes, then kindness from you is not simple. Kindness is rarely simple. That does not make it false. A faint change moved through her expression. Not trust, not yet, but attention. She looked toward the window where rain threaded the glass. I should not have come this way. Where were you going? Silence. The fire snapped softly. Away, she said at last. Away is not a destination. It is when the place behind you is worse. Sebastian let that answer remain between them. A careless man would have pressed the wound because curiosity demanded blood. He had no intention of becoming careless, merely because the mystery was personal. You told Dr. Merriweather your name is Mary Fenn. It is, her reply came too quickly. And you are companion at Kersey House. I was. To Lady Augusta Kersey? Her mouth grew still at the name. Yes, were you dismissed? No. Did you leave with permission? She looked at the locket instead of him. No. The honesty cost her, he respected that, and the respect unsettled him. Then they may come for you. Her hand trembled once. She forced it still. They will, and you fear being sent back. She turned her face away. I fear many things, Your Grace. Being sent back is merely the one most likely to happen. Sebastian felt the anger again, colder now and more disciplined. No one will remove you from this house tonight. You cannot know what they will say. I know what I will allow. That is not the same thing. The correction was quiet, but it struck cleanly. She was right. Protection spoken from power often sounded like certainty to the powerful and like another locked door to everyone else. Sebastian inclined his head. No, it is not. Surprise flickered over her features. He saw then how unused she was to being answered instead of overruled. I will not ask you for more than you can tell, he said. But I must ask one thing, the name in that locket. Marianne Fairholt. How did it come to be in your possession? The blood left her face so swiftly that he regretted the question before the final word had settled. She clutched the locket to her breast. You opened it. The hinge gave while Mrs. Pym was returning it to me. I saw the engraving. I will not pretend otherwise. You had no right. No. The single word disarmed her more thoroughly than any defense would have. He continued. But now that I have seen it, I cannot ignore it. It is only a name. It is not only a name to me. Her eyes lifted, fear sharpened. You know it. Sebastian did not answer at once. A log shifted in the grate. Outside, wheels sounded faintly in the stable yard, then faded. My mother knew the Fairholt family. Years ago, she believed a child named Marianne Fairholt had died. The woman stared at him. Her lips parted, but no words came. Miss Fenn, he said gently. Are you Marianne Fairholt? No. The denial was immediate, too immediate. Her hand flew to her throat, as if the locket might betray her by beating. No, I am Mary Fenn. I was taken into Kersey House as a child. Lady Augusta said my parents were no one worth naming. She said the locket was a wicked vanity, and that if I told stories about it, I would be turned out. Do you remember being called Marianne? She shut her eyes. In the firelight, he saw the child she had once been, trained to bury memory because memory angered those who fed her. Sometimes, she whispered. In dreams, a woman's voice, violets on a dressing table. Someone crying when I would not stop coughing. Then Lady Augusta would say I had a fevered imagination. Do you speak French? Her eyes opened, wary again. A little. Latin? Only prayers. Who taught you? I do not know. Companions from servant stock are not generally taught French and Latin prayers. A fragile spark appeared beneath her exhaustion. Perhaps I was an unusually troublesome servant. The corner of his mouth almost moved. Perhaps, for the first time. She seemed startled by her own attempt at wit. It vanished quickly. Please do not write to them. To Kersey House? If they know where I am, they will come. They may already know. Her fingers went white around the locket. Sebastian stood, slowly enough not to alarm her. You are tired. Eat what Mrs. Pym brings. Sleep if you can. Lady Beatrice Anstruther will arrive before evening. So there will be a proper chaperone in the house. Until then, Mrs. Pym will remain near you. Why would you trouble yourself? The question was not coy. It was raw. He looked at the cracked locket in her hands. Then, at the woman who had offered him a false name. With the bearing of someone born to a true one. Because a name my mother mourned has appeared in my house on a woman who begged not to be sent back. That is not trouble, Miss Fenn. It is a summons. Her eyes filled suddenly, though no tear fell. I'm not what you think. I have not decided what I think. Don't make me into someone grand because of a locket. Then do not make yourself small because someone ordered you to. She looked down, and the words seemed to reach a place no broth or fire could warm. Sebastian left before pity could become another burden upon her. In the corridor, Mrs. Pym waited with a tray. Broth, Your Grace. Take it in. Stay until she has eaten. Yes, Your Grace. He had barely reached the head of the staircase when Harrow appeared below, controlled but urgent. Your Grace. Sebastian descended 3 steps. What is it? The butler held a calling card between 2 gloved fingers, though no caller of rank would have arrived at that hour by the servant's entrance. A groom from Kersey House is at the gate. He asks whether we have seen a runaway female servant by the name of Mary Fenn. Sebastian looked toward the closed blue chamber door. Behind it, the woman with Marianne Fairholt's name in her hands was trying to swallow her first spoonful of broth, without trembling. When he answered, his voice was quiet enough to make Harrow straighten. Tell him no servant by that description is available to him here. The groom from Kersey House did not leave after Harrow delivered the Duke's refusal. He waited at the gate beneath the dripping branches, as if endurance might become authority, his cap pulled low, his shoulders hunched against the rein, one gloved hand holding the reins of a tired bay horse. Sebastian watched him from the library window without moving. The lamps had been lit, but the evening beyond the glass remained a blurred gray, full of wet gravel, black trees, and the low shining line of the drive. Behind him the fire burned with a steadiness the house had not possessed since the stranger arrived. No servant spoke above a murmur. No door closed without care. Alderwick Park had taken in a secret, and every wall seemed to know it. He says he cannot return without her, Harrow said from near the door. He used those words, Sebastian asked. Yes, Your Grace. Without her. Sebastian turned from the window. Not without news of her, not without assurance of her safety. No, Your Grace. Then he has been sent for property, not a person. Harrow's expression did not change, but his silence agreed. Sebastian walked to the writing table where the groom's calling card lay beside a sealed note that had arrived with him. The card was plain, bearing no name but that of Kersey House. The letter was not plain. It was heavy cream paper, folded sharply, sealed with red wax, and scented faintly with violet water, as if elegance could sweeten command. He broke the seal. Lady Augusta Kersey's hand was tall, severe, and perfectly legible. Your Grace, I am informed that a young woman answering to the name of Mary Fenn has been seen in the neighborhood of Alderwick Park. Miss Fenn is a dependent of my household, and has lately shown signs of nervous disturbance, ingratitude, and deceit. She left without permission after taking certain articles not belonging to her. Her condition renders her unfit to judge what is best for herself. I must therefore request that, should she have found her way into your protection by misrepresentation, you return her at once to those who have long borne the burden of her care. I need not remind Your Grace that a woman of doubtful character, found upon the road and kept beneath a bachelor's roof, may become a subject of unfortunate speculation. I write from concern for all reputations involved. Lady Augusta Kersey. Sebastian read the letter once. Then he read it again because cold anger required precision. Deceit, burden, return. Doubtful character. It was a well-made trap, every word polished enough for society, and sharp enough to cut the woman upstairs from any claim to pity. Lady Augusta had not asked whether Mary Fenn was alive. She had not asked whether she was ill. She had asked for her return, and had wrapped the demand in the language of propriety. Give the groom food in the outer yard, Sebastian said. Then send him back with my compliments. Tell him that no woman will be removed from Alderwick Park tonight. Shall I say Miss Fenn is here? You shall say exactly what I have said. Harrow bowed. Very good, Your Grace. At the door, the butler paused. Lady Beatrice Anstruther's carriage has been sighted at the south turn. She should arrive within 20 minutes. Have rooms prepared. Already done. When Harrow withdrew, Sebastian remained with Lady Augusta's letter in his hand. He thought of Mary Fenn, or Marianne Fairholt, or whatever name fear had taught her to answer to. Lying in the blue chamber, with broth cooling beside her, and a cracked locket, clutched like a passport out of oblivion. He thought of the way she had apologized for fainting. It was not weakness that troubled him, it was training. Someone had taught her that distress was an offense and need a form of misconduct. A knock came lightly at the library door. Mrs. Pym entered before he could answer fully, which meant the matter was urgent. "Your Grace, Miss Fenn is not in her chamber." The letter crumpled slightly in his hand. "Not in her chamber?" The maid left her for no more than 3 minutes to fetch fresh linen. The window is closed, the bed is turned down, and the locket is gone. Sebastian was already moving. "Which stairs?" "Jenny saw a figure near the back passage, Your Grace. She thought it was one of the kitchen maids until she noticed the white wrapper under a cloak." He reached the servants' passage in less than a minute. Alderwick Park was large, built for display in front and labor behind, with corridors that ran unseen beneath the polished dignity of the main rooms. The air there smelled of coal, soap, and damp wool. Footsteps echoed ahead, soft and uneven. Sebastian slowed before he turned the corner, not because he wished to surprise her, but because he did not want to send her running into the dark. She stood near the side door that led to the service yard, one hand braced against the wall, the other gripping the locket at her throat. Someone had given her a cloak, or she had found one. It swallowed her frame. Beneath it, the borrowed wrapper brushed her ankles. She had no bonnet. Her hair, hastily braided, had half come loose over one shoulder. She looked impossibly fragile and impossibly determined. "Miss Fenn," Sebastian said. She went still. "Not caught like a thief. Not guilty, cornered." Then she turned, her chin lifting with that painful discipline he had begun to recognize. "Your Grace, you were told to remain in bed. I was told many things today." Her voice shook, but she did not lower it. "That does not mean I have obeyed wisely. The physician said you may collapse again." "Then I shall collapse somewhere that does not injure your name." He stopped several feet away. The space mattered. He could see her counting it. "Is that why you are leaving?" Her laugh was so small it barely existed. "There are several reasons, that is the kindest one. The groom at the gate brought a letter from Lady Augusta." Her face changed. Nothing dramatic. No cry. No visible collapse. The color simply left her, and the hand on the wall pressed harder. "What did she say?" "That you are deceitful, nervous, ungrateful, and must be returned." Marianne shut her eyes for a second. "Yes, that sounds like Lady Augusta. She also wrote that you took articles not belonging to you." Her hand closed over the locket. "This is mine, I believe you." Her eyes opened. The words had reached her before she was ready for them. "You should not." "Why?" "Because you do not know me. I know her letter, that is not the same." "No. But it is enough to know she cares more for possession than safety." Marianne looked toward the door. Rain ran down the small square of glass, set high in the panel. Beyond it lay the yard, the stables, the wet drive, and a road that had already defeated her once. "If I stay, she will say I deceived you. She will say I came here by design. She will say you took in a woman, without family, without name, without virtue. People will listen because she says such things softly. And if you leave, then the scandal ends at your gate. And you?" Her mouth trembled once before she mastered it. "I have survived worse than being spoken of." That was not an answer. "It is the only one I can afford." Sebastian looked at her bare hand against the wall. The fingers were white from effort. She was standing by will alone. "You owe me no protection," he said. "I am aware of that." "Then do not pretend that walking into the rain is generosity." Anger flickered through her fear. It made her seem suddenly more alive. "Do not pretend keeping me here is simple charity. I do not. You are a duke. You think your roof makes anything beneath it safe." "No." He took a breath, steadying the answer. "I think my roof makes me responsible. Responsibility can become a chain, so can fear." She looked at him then, directly. The corridor lantern cast shadows beneath her eyes, but the gray of them was clear. "You speak as if I have choices." "You do." "No, I have consequences." The words were quiet and exact. "If I return, Lady Augusta will lock away the locket and call me hysterical until I agree I invented the engraving. If I run, I become what she says I am. If I stay, your house becomes part of my disgrace. Those are not choices. Those are different doors into the same room. Sebastian felt the sentence settle in him. He had heard women speak cleverly in drawing rooms, and men speak grandly in Parliament. He had rarely heard suffering describe itself with such restraint. Then, let us find a door she did not build. Marianne stared at him. There may not be one. There is always one. It is merely hidden by people who profit from the walls. A faint sound came from the far end of the passage. Mrs. Pym had stopped there, holding a shawl. She did not approach. Good woman, Sebastian thought. Marianne heard the sound and stiffened, shame returning. Your servants will talk. They will obey. That is what servants do in front of masters. They still have tongues. Then I shall give them a better truth to repeat. You are a guest in my house, taken ill upon the road, attended by a physician, and chaperoned by Lady Beatrice Anstruther, by nightfall. No one in Alderwick Park will call you a runaway servant. The locket trembled against her throat. Lady Augusta will. Lady Augusta is not mistress here. She will not forgive this. I have not asked her to. Marianne looked down, and for the first time since he had found her, she seemed close to tears. None fell. He suspected she had trained them not to. I do not want to be a burden. You are a woman who collapsed 2 miles from my gate. His voice softened despite himself. If that is a burden, then my title is worth less than the mud on my boots. She looked up quickly, startled by the roughness in the remark. For one suspended moment, the corridor felt less like the hidden underside of a great house, and more like a narrow bridge neither of them knew how to cross. You cannot fight Lady Augusta for a stranger, she said. I am not fighting for a stranger, her breath caught. Sebastian heard his own words only after they had left him, and he amended them with care. I am protecting a guest whose name has been used against her. Whether that name is Mary Fenn or Marianne Fairholt, you will not be dragged from this house. The name struck her like light through a shutter. Do not say it where anyone can hear. Then come away from the servant's door. She looked again at the rain-streaked glass. Her escape had been real to her. So had the terror behind it. To return upstairs was not surrender, and he needed her to know that. You may leave Alderwick Park when you are strong enough to choose it, he said. Not because a groom waits at the gate. Not because Lady Augusta writes threats on expensive paper. Not because you think my reputation matters more than your safety. Her lips pressed together. And if I choose to leave tomorrow, then I will ask where you wish to go, and how I may see you arrive safely. I will not send you back. You promise? I do. Her strength gave out in the smallest possible way. She did not fall. She merely leaned more heavily against the wall, and the gesture made him take one step forward before he stopped himself. May Mrs. Pym assist you? He asked. Yes, she whispered. Mrs. Pym came at once, and wrapped the shawl around her shoulders with a tenderness that pretended to be briskness. Marianne allowed it, but before turning away she looked at Sebastian. I'm sorry I tried to leave. Do not apologize for trying to survive, her eyes shone. I don't know how to do anything else. Then for tonight, do less of it alone. She had no answer. Mrs. Pym guided her back toward the main corridor, not the servant's stair, and after a few steps Marianne straightened, as if remembering that even retreat could be done with dignity. Sebastian waited until she was out of sight, before returning to the front hall. Harrow was there. Rain damp upon his sleeve from speaking at the gate. The groom has gone, Your Grace. Good, he said. Lady Augusta will send again. I expect she will. At that moment, wheels sounded on the drive. Firmer and more elegant than a servant's cart. Through the open inner door, Sebastian saw the lamps of another carriage approaching. Lady Beatrice Anstruther had arrived, bringing propriety with her like a drawn sword. Sebastian folded Lady Augusta's letter once and placed it inside his coat. Have Lady Beatrice shown to the drawing room, he said. And Harrow, yes. Your Grace, from this hour Miss Fenn is to be treated as a guest under my protection. Anyone who finds that confusing may seek another position. Harrow bowed, and this time there was no hesitation at all. Perfectly understood, Your Grace. Lady Beatrice Anstruther took possession of Alderwick Park within 20 minutes of her arrival. and by breakfast, the next morning, even the most imaginative housemaid would have struggled to make scandal out of a convalescent woman guarded by a widow of 60, a physician, a housekeeper, and the Duke of Belmere's most forbidding silence. Lady Beatrice was small, silver-haired, and sharper than most men, with twice her fortune. She listened to Sebastian's account in the drawing-room the night before, without wasting sympathy on exclamations, then asked to see the young woman herself. She returned half an hour later with her mouth compressed and her black-gloved hands folded over the silver head of her cane. "That child has been taught to apologize for taking up air," she said. "Yes," Sebastian replied. "Then do not bully her with rescue." He looked at his late mother's oldest friend and might have resented the remark from anyone else. From Lady Beatrice, he accepted it as instruction. "I intend to visit Kersey House in the morning." "Of course you do. Men always prefer an enemy they can call upon." "Would you advise against it?" "No. I would advise you to watch before you strike." That advice remained with him when his carriage turned through the gates of Kersey House, shortly after 11 the next morning. The rain had passed, but the world it left behind was raw and shining. Kersey House stood 3 miles beyond the village, handsome from a distance, with pale stone, trimmed hedges, and a portico designed to persuade visitors that order lived within. Sebastian distrusted houses that seemed too eager to look respectable. A footman took his card with a visible flinch at the crest. No household ignored a duke. It could delay, misdirect, or pretend confusion, but it could not refuse him without making a louder statement than welcome would have done. He was shown into a drawing room where everything had been arranged to express taste without warmth. The chairs were carved and uncomfortable. The fire was built high but gave little comfort. A pianoforte stood open with music displayed upon it, though no one had been playing. On a small table lay a vase of violets. Sebastian looked at them longer than the servant expected, then turned away before the old memory could soften his face. Lady Augusta Kersey entered with the grave composure of a woman who considered emotion a vulgar habit in others. She was tall, narrow, and dressed in dove-gray silk. Her cap was edged with lace so fine it seemed almost accusation against anyone less carefully preserved. Behind her came Miss Octavia Kersey, younger, fair, and pretty in the way of a porcelain shepherdess placed on a mantle to be admired from a safe distance. Her eyes were not porcelain. They were quick and pleased by injury. "Your Grace," Lady Augusta said, sinking into a curtsy measured to the exact inch due to his rank. "This is an unexpected honor, Lady Augusta," Sebastian bowed. "I trust my note yesterday did not alarm you beyond necessity." Her fingers folded over one another. "A dependent of my household disappears in a troubled state, and I learn she may have placed herself in a gentleman's home. Alarm seems natural." Concern also would have seemed natural. A pause followed. Octavia's gaze sharpened. Lady Augusta's smile did not alter. "You must forgive a woman who has borne the burden of Mary Fenn for many years. Affection sometimes grows fatigued when met with ingratitude. How long has Miss Fenn lived here? Since childhood? As a servant? As a dependent?" "That is a flexible word. It needed to be." Her origins were uncertain. Her temperament was more so. Sebastian accepted the cup of tea, offered by a maid, and did not drink it. "Who placed her with you?" Lady Augusta looked mildly wounded. "Your Grace asks as if this were a matter of transaction rather than charity. Charity usually remembers the terms by which it begins." Octavia gave a little laugh, bright and brittle. Mary would adore hearing herself discussed like a person of consequence. She was always fanciful that way. Lady Augusta's head turned a fraction. The girl fell silent, though not repentant. Sebastian looked at her. Fanciful, Octavia lowered her lashes with a performance of reluctance. "Oh, I shouldn't speak unkindly. It's only that Mary has always had notions. She would copy old handwriting, practice French phrases she did not understand, and carry herself as if she had misplaced a carriage instead of never owning one. Astonishing behavior in a companion," Sebastian said, "to improve her hand, her language, and her posture." Octavia's cheeks colored. Lady Augusta set down her cup. Mary was not a companion in the true sense. She assisted where she was useful. Read aloud when my eyes were tired. Mended linen when the maids were occupied. Sat with my sister during her final illness. Such tasks should have taught humility. Where was her room? The question landed like a dropped glass. Lady Augusta's eyes cooled. Her room? Yes. Surely your grace does not intend to inspect my household arrangements. I intend to understand the condition in which a woman left your house and fainted on the road. Mary is dramatic. Exhaustion is rarely theatrical. Octavia shifted. She never liked the room, because it was not grand enough. That was the trouble, Lady Augusta stood. If it will satisfy your grace, Mrs. Bell can show you. I cannot imagine what enlightenment may be found in a bedchamber. Truth often hides where comfort does not. He followed the housekeeper up two flights, and then along a narrower passage where the carpet ended. The air changed there. It was not dirty, precisely, but colder and plainer, with the faint smell of stored trunks, old paper and lavender, used too sparingly to be pleasant. Mrs. Bell opened a door near the attic stair. Miss Fenn slept here, Your Grace. The room was small enough that Sebastian understood it in one glance. A narrow bed, one washstand. A chair with a mended rush seat, a shelf of books too high to reach easily, a locked writing box on a table scarred by years of use. The window looked not over garden or lawn, but toward a sloped roof and the chimney pots. On a peg hung a gray gown, brushed clean and repaired with the same minute stitches he had noticed on the road. There was nothing openly cruel. That was what made it worse. No one could point to the room and cry outrage before witnesses. It merely reduced a person by inches until she learned to stand smaller. Sebastian crossed to the table. Who has the key to the writing box? Mrs. Bell Augusta, Your Grace. Not Miss Fenn? No, Your Grace. Did Miss Fenn receive letters? Not often. Did she send them? The housekeeper lowered her gaze. I could not say. That means you could. Silence. Sebastian did not force it. A frightened servant would protect her position before a stranger's truth. He turned toward the shelf. The books were old schoolroom volumes, French grammar, a prayer book, a Latin primer with the spine cracked. Inside the cover of the primer, in a faded childish hand, someone had written MF. The letters had been scratched over, not completely enough to erase them. He looked at the marks until they became more eloquent than any testimony Lady Augusta might offer. When he descended, Lady Augusta was waiting in the drawing room with Octavia at her side. Neither asked what he had seen. That told him they already knew. I hope Your Grace is satisfied that Mary was treated with more generosity than her station warranted, Lady Augusta said. Her station is precisely the matter in question. Her station is whatever charity allowed her to occupy. No, a person's station is not created by another person's convenience. For the first time, Lady Augusta's expression altered. A thin line appeared beside her mouth. Your Grace is moved by a pretty face and a sad tale. It happens even to careful men, but I assure you. Mary Fenn is not a gentlewoman wronged by cruel guardians. She is a disturbed young person with a habit of attachment to objects and stories not her own. The locket, for instance. Octavia's lips parted. Lady Augusta was still. A stolen vanity, she said. From whom, I beg your pardon? You called it stolen. From whom was it stolen? It belonged among old effects. Mary found it and became absurdly attached. Old effects of whom? Lady Augusta rose with the controlled force of a door closing. Your Grace, I have shown patience. I must now insist that Mary be returned before this foolishness injures everyone involved. If she has told you some nonsense about being a lady, I urge you to remember that gratitude in such girls often curdles into fantasy. Give them bread, and they invent birthright. Give them shelter, and they claim blood. Sebastian placed his untouched cup upon the table. You speak of her as though she were not alive when absent from the room. I speak as one who knows her. No, he said quietly. You speak as one who fears being known by her. Octavia made a small sound. Lady Augusta's hand tightened on her fan until the ivory sticks creaked. No violence, no raised voice. Only the first fracture in perfect manners. Be careful, Your Grace, she said. A woman without a name can stain even a ducal threshold if she remains there long enough. Sebastian bowed, not deeply. Then you will be relieved to know I do not intend her to remain without a name. He left before she could answer. On the drive back to Alderwick Park, he held his silence so completely that even the coachman seemed to guide the horses more quietly. He had gone to Kersey House, expecting evasion. He had found a room designed to make a child grateful for neglect, a locked writing box, school books marked with initials someone had tried to scrape away, and a woman of rank who feared a cracked locket more than she feared a duke. When he entered Alderwick Park, Lady Beatrice was in the morning room with a stack of correspondence beside her, and a face that said she had already learned three things no one intended to tell her. Marianne sat near the fire, wrapped in a shawl, pale but upright. The locket lay beneath her hand. She looked toward the door the moment he entered. He had schooled his face before crossing the threshold. Yet her eyes found the anger he had hidden from servants, from Lady Augusta, perhaps even from himself. She saw it and went very still. "You went there," she said. Sebastian removed his glove slowly. "Yes, you saw the room." He did not ask how she knew. "Yes." Her fingers pressed the locket flat against her breast. For a moment, shame passed through her like a shadow. Then she lifted her chin. "Not far, just enough." "It was better than some rooms," she said. Lady Beatrice's cane struck the floor once. "My dear, that sentence is not a defense of the room. It is an indictment of the life." Marianne's mouth trembled, but she did not look away from Sebastian. "Did Lady Augusta tell you I am ungrateful? Among other things, and did you believe her?" "No." The answer was immediate. Something in her face broke open and closed again before tears could escape. "You should be more cautious, Your Grace." "I am cautious." He crossed only to the edge of the firelight, no closer. "That is why I came back angry instead of merely offended." Lady Beatrice watched them both and said nothing. Marianne lowered her eyes to the cracked locket. "She called it stolen, didn't she?" Sebastian's silence answered. Her hand closed over it. "Then she is more afraid than I thought." Outside, the clouds shifted, letting a thin, colorless light pass across the wet lawn. Inside, Sebastian knew the matter had changed. He had brought an unknown woman into his house out of decency. He would keep her there now, because somewhere inside Kersey House, behind polished doors and careful lies, lay the beginning of a theft older than the rain-soaked road where he had found her. That afternoon, before dinner, he wrote to the solicitor who had once handled his mother's private affairs, and sealed the letter himself. The name at the center of it was not Mary Fenn, it was Fairholt. The first time Marianne said her own name aloud in Alderwick Park, she whispered it as if the walls might report her. "Marianne." The word slipped from her lips in the morning room, and vanished almost at once into the soft snap of the fire. She sat beside the window, with the cracked ivory locket lying open in her palm. Its hinge mended only enough to keep it from falling apart. The tiny lock of dark baby hair, and the engraved name, exposed to the pale Hampshire light. 2 days had passed since Sebastian had returned from Kersey House, with anger hidden under perfect manners. In those 2 days, Mrs. Pym had fed Marianne broth, tea, toast, and patience. Lady Beatrice had placed herself between the blue chamber and every rumor that might have tried to climb the stairs. Sebastian had not pressed. That, more than anything, unsettled Marianne. She knew interrogation. She knew correction. She knew the smooth cruelty of questions designed to make the answerer smaller. She did not know what to do with the Duke who waited. Lady Beatrice sat opposite her, knitting something black and severe that appeared to grow no larger, no matter how long she worked on it. Sebastian stood near the mantel, one shoulder turned toward the room, a letter unopened in his hand. He had brought it in 10 minutes earlier, then had said nothing when he saw the locket open on Marianne's palm. Silence had gathered. Not empty silence. Listening silence. Marianne looked down at the engraved words again. "Marianne Fairholt." The letters had always seemed both intimate and forbidden, like a prayer stolen from a chapel. "I was very young," she said. Her voice surprised her by remaining steady. "I do not know how young, Four, perhaps. Five. Old enough to remember colors better than faces. There was a room with blue curtains, not here, somewhere brighter. There were violets painted on a little basin, and a woman who smelled of rose soap and ink. Lady Beatrice's needles stilled. Sebastian did not move. She called me Marianne, Marianne continued. Not often in the memories, only once clearly. I had hidden beneath a table because I had broken a cup. She lifted the cloth and said, Marianne, little one, China is not worth tears. A faint, disbelieving smile touched her mouth and left. At Kersey House, China was always worth tears. Sebastian's hand closed around the letter, but his voice, when it came, was controlled. Was that woman your mother? I do not know. The answer was honest and painful. For years I told myself she was. Then Lady Augusta said, I had stolen memories the way I had stolen heirs. She said children without breeding often invented grand origins to comfort themselves. How charitable of her, Lady Beatrice said. She did not think charity should be comfortable, Marianne said. She said, comfort spoiled dependence. The words came more easily now, which frightened her. The more truth left her mouth, the less she knew how to gather herself afterward. When I first came to Kersey House, I had the locket, I remember that, because I bit the chain once and was scolded for leaving marks upon it. Lady Augusta took it away. I cried until I was sick. She returned it after 3 days and told me I might keep it if I never showed it to visitors and never spoke the name inside. Why did she return it? Sebastian asked. Because I stopped eating. Marianne looked at him quickly, as if expecting censure for the confession. He gave none. That was worse somehow. Gentleness made room for sorrow. I was not brave. I was stubborn in the way children are when they know only one thing belongs to them. That is not the opposite of bravery, he said. Her fingers curled around the locket. Perhaps. Later, when I was older, she said, the locket had belonged to a dead child from a disgraced family. She said my attachment to it was morbid. She said if I repeated the name Marianne Fairholt, people would laugh and ask whether a kitchen chair had decided it was a duchess. Lady Beatrice's needles clicked once, hard. Vile woman. She never shouted, Marianne said. That made it easier for others to believe her. She sounded reasonable. I sounded ungrateful. Sebastian crossed to the small table and set the unopened letter down. The name Fairholt was not disgraced in my mother's memory. Marianne looked up. Your mother truly knew them? Yes. Lady Helena Vale, my mother, was a friend of Mrs. Fairholt before her marriage. In her papers, there were mentions of Fairholt Grange. I remembered only fragments until your locket forced the memory forward. Fairholt Grange, Marianne repeated. Something within the name brushed against her like a half-remembered melody. There was a gate with stone birds. Sebastian's eyes sharpened. There are stone falcons on the old gateposts at Fairholt Grange. The room went quiet. Marianne felt the color drain from her face, though she remained sitting very still. If she moved, she feared the memory would break. I thought I had invented them. You did not. Three words. They landed with the weight of a door unlocking. Lady Beatrice leaned forward. My dear, what else do you remember? Pieces. Marianne shook her head. Piece, a staircase that turned twice, a man laughing somewhere below, a little dog with one white ear, fever, someone crying, then Kersey House. Lady Augusta, a black dress, a woman saying I must be useful if I wish to stay. Who was the woman? Sebastian asked. Lady Augusta, her throat tightened. She told me my parents had died under circumstances no decent household would discuss. She said she had taken me in out of Christian duty, though I had no claim upon her. I believed her because there was no one else to ask. And the name Mary Fenn? She gave it to me. She said Marianne was unsuitable, too fanciful, too above me. For the first time. Bitterness rose with enough force to warm her blood. I learned to answer to Mary because unanswered names brought punishment of a quieter kind. Meals forgotten. Books locked away. Letters burned before I could see the direction. Sebastian's expression darkened. Letters. I do not know whether they were for me. I only saw them once in Lady Augusta's hand. She noticed me looking and said, no one writes to Mary Fenn unless I permit it. After that, I never saw letters left anywhere I might reach. Lady Beatrice set her knitting aside. Your Grace? That letter you brought in, is it from the solicitor? Sebastian picked it up. From Mr. Edmund Penrose of Winchester. He handled some private matters for my mother after my father died. I wrote, asking whether the Fairholt name appeared in any surviving correspondence. Marianne's hand tightened at once. You wrote about me. He heard the fear beneath the question, and answered it carefully. I wrote about the name, not your condition. Not your presence here, beyond saying. A woman had appeared with an object bearing an old engraving. I did not use the name Mary Fenn. Still, it is my name. Yes. A small silence followed. He set the letter down again, unopened. Would you prefer to read it first? Marianne stared at him. You would allow that. It concerns you. Men do not usually hand women the papers that decide them. Then men are usually wrong. Lady Beatrice made a soft sound that might have been approval or impatience. Marianne looked from Sebastian to the letter. The old habit rose in her. Defer. Apologize. Let those with power discover what they wish, then accept whatever version of truth they find convenient. She saw Lady Augusta's face, composed and pale. Telling her gratitude would suit her better than imagination. Slowly Marianne closed the locket. No, she said. Read it aloud. Sebastian inclined his head, but before he could break the seal, she lifted one hand. But the locket stays with me. He looked at her. Of course. No, not of course. I need to say it. Her heart was beating too fast, yet the words came. Your Grace may protect me. You may ask questions. You may write to solicitors and speak to people who would never answer a woman like me. But my name is not evidence to be kept in another man's drawer. Lady Beatrice's face softened. Sebastian stood utterly still. Then he bowed to her. Not deeply. Not theatrically. But with a respect so clean that Marianne felt it more keenly than any compliment. You are right. I was wrong to hold it even for an hour. Her eyes stung. I did not say that to make you kind, I know. I said it, because if I do not begin somewhere, I shall always wait for permission to exist. His gaze changed. No pity. Recognition. Then begin there. Marianne drew the chain over her head, with unsteady fingers, and fastened the locket at her throat. It lay warm against her skin, visible above the borrowed gown. She did not hide it beneath the collar. Sebastian opened the letter. The paper crackled. Mr. Penrose writes that Mr. Alaric Fairholt of Fairholt Grange died 12 years ago after a fever that also took his wife. Their only child, Marianne Fairholt, was reported dead shortly thereafter, though no burial record was found among the papers available to him at the time. A portion of the Fairholt estate and fortune was held in trust pending settlement of certain family obligations. He notes that Lady Augusta Kersey's late husband had some connection to the trusteeship. Marianne could hear the clock on the mantel. Each tick seemed too loud. No burial record, Lady Beatrice said. That is not proof, but it is a crack in the wall. Sebastian lowered the paper. He also writes that if the child lived, the matter would be grave. Grave, Marianne repeated faintly. That is a polite word for theft. It may be many things before it is finished, Sebastian said. But it is no longer only memory. She looked toward the window. The lawns of Alderwick Park stretched wet and green beyond the glass. Somewhere beyond them lay Kersey House. Beyond that, perhaps. Fairholt Grange with stone falcons at the gate. If I am not Mary Fenn, she said, then I do not know who I have been all these years. Lady Beatrice rose and came to stand beside a chair. You have been yourself, my dear. Other people merely mislabeled the package. The absurdity of it drew a breath from Marianne that almost became a laugh. It broke into something softer. She covered her mouth, ashamed of the sound. Sebastian turned toward the fire, long enough to give her privacy. That, too, she noticed. At that moment, the door opened after a careful knock, and Harrow entered with a small silver tray. A note has arrived for Lady Beatrice, Your Grace. Also a card from Mrs. Pemberton of Westbrook Lodge. Lady Beatrice took both, read the first, then lifted one brow. The county assembly is tomorrow evening. Marianne's body remembered fear before her mind did. Lady Augusta will be there. Undoubtedly, Lady Beatrice said. So will half the people she most wishes to influence. Sebastian looked at Marianne. You need not attend. The old Mary Fenn would have accepted escape as mercy. Marianne Fairholt, whose name still felt new upon her tongue, touched the locket outside her gown. If I hide, she will say hiding proves guilt. She will say something cruel regardless, Lady Beatrice replied. That is what empty women do when frightened. Marianne rose too quickly, then steadied herself on the chair. Sebastian did not reach for her, he waited. She saw this restraint and understood it as trust. Then I will go, she said. Not as a challenge, not as a spectacle. I will go, because I am tired of learning what is said about me, only after the door has closed. Sebastian's expression remained controlled, but something in his eyes warmed. Then Lady Beatrice will chaperone you. I will be present. And if they call me Mary, her voice was quiet. He answered with the same quiet. Then you may decide whether to answer. Marianne looked down at the locket, then back at him. For the first time in years, the name inside it did not feel like a dangerous secret. It felt like a question waiting for her courage. Marianne, she said once more, barely above a whisper. No punishment came, only the fire, the rain's soft light, and the Duke of Belmere, standing beside the mantel, as though he had heard a vow. By the hour appointed for the Hampshire Assembly, Marianne had discovered that courage could be laced into a borrowed gown, as tightly as fear. Lady Beatrice had chosen the dress from a trunk of garments kept at Alderwick Park for unexpected guests. A soft blue silk altered in haste by Mrs. Pym, and two maids who pretended not to notice how Marianne stood too still during the fitting. The gown was modest, almost severe, with long sleeves and a high neckline that allowed the cracked ivory locket to rest in plain sight. Marianne had tried once to tuck it away. Lady Beatrice had caught her wrist with surprising gentleness. My dear, if you hide it tonight, they will teach you to hide it forever. So the locket remained visible. It lay against her breast like a small, pale wound. Sebastian saw it the moment she entered the hall. He had been standing beside the foot of the staircase, with his gloves in one hand, and his face arranged into that calm, ducal mask, which made footmen straighten, and timid men reconsider opinions. Yet the mask altered when he saw her, not much. A less observant woman might have missed it. Marianne did not. His gaze moved from the locket to her face, and something in his expression settled, as if she had answered a question he had not dared to ask. Miss Fenn, he said. He used the name she had chosen to endure in public, but he bowed as if addressing someone society had not yet learned to recognize. Lady Beatrice adjusted one black glove. She is ready. Your Grace, whether Hampshire is ready is another matter. Marianne managed a breath. It is only an assembly. Lady Beatrice gave her a look. So is a battlefield if one describes it badly. Sebastian offered his arm to the older lady first as propriety required, then turned to Marianne before they walked out. If at any moment you wish to leave, you have only to say so. And if I wish to stay, then we stay. Such a simple answer, such an unfamiliar thing. The drive to the assembly rooms took less than 30 minutes, though Marianne felt every yard of it. Outside the carriage, the night pressed dark against the windows. Inside, Lady Beatrice spoke of weather, horses, and a dreadful pianoforte performance she had once survived in Bath. As if ordinary talk could build a railing over an abyss. Sebastian said little, but his silence did not crowd her. It waited beside her. When the carriage stopped, voices reached them first. Then music, then the glow of lamps spilling from tall windows onto wet stone steps. Marianne's hand tightened around her reticule. The last time she had attended a county gathering with Lady Augusta, she had stood behind chairs, fetched shawls, and been thanked only when someone remembered that silence could also serve. Tonight, she entered through the front doors with Lady Beatrice Anstruther and the Duke of Belmere. The room changed before anyone spoke. It was not a grand London ballroom. Only a respectable county assembly room with polished floors, greenery around the sconces, and musicians seated at one end. Yet to Marianne, it seemed vast. Every turn of a head became a verdict. Every fan paused halfway through a flutter. The whispers began near the refreshment table and passed from group to group with the swift delicacy of infection. That is the woman from the road. The one at Alderwick Park. Kersey's companion. No, not companion. Something worse, surely. Marianne heard none of the words clearly and all of them perfectly. Lady Beatrice placed two fingers on her arm. Do not shrink, it rewards them. Marianne lifted her chin. She had been invisible for years. Being seen felt almost indecent. Across the room, Lady Augusta Kersey stood beside a cluster of local matrons in lavender-gray satin, her posture faultless, her face composed. Octavia was with her, dressed in white muslin with pink ribbons, looking fresh, innocent, and bright enough to make cruelty appear youthful rather than ugly. Lady Augusta's gaze found Marianne's locket, then rose to her face. No shock showed. That was how Marianne knew the older woman was furious. Lady Beatrice, murmured a nearby gentleman, bowing. Your Grace. His eyes moved to Marianne and faltered. Sebastian's voice was even. Miss Fenn is Lady Beatrice's guest this evening. The words did not explain her. They placed a boundary around her. Marianne felt the room adjust itself by a fraction. A duke had spoken. Not enough to grant acceptance, but enough to forbid open insult from the timid. Unfortunately, Octavia Kersey had never been timid when injury could be made decorative. She crossed the floor with two young ladies trailing her like pale ribbons. Mary, she said, sweetly, loudly enough for the nearest circle to hear. How well you look after alarming everyone so dreadfully. Marianne felt the name strike. Mary, the old command, the old leash. She curtsied, not low. Miss Kersey. Octavia's smile widened. Miss Kersey, how formal. We are all astonished to see you recovered enough for company. Only yesterday we were told you were too unwell to return home. I was unwell, Marianne said. The physician advised rest. And jewels. Apparently, Octavia's gaze dropped to the locket. A woman nearby pretended to study her fan. How curious that such a trinket survived your ordeal on the road. Lady Beatrice's hand tightened on her cane, but she did not speak. Sebastian, standing a few steps away, watched with an expression that would have frightened a wiser opponent. Marianne felt his attention like a hand near her back, not touching, only steadying. It has survived worse than rain, she said. Octavia blinked. A few people heard and leaned closer. How dramatic you have become. One might think you were born for drawing rooms. One may learn a great deal in corridors, Marianne replied. People speak more honestly when they believe one has no importance. The nearest matron's fan stopped moving altogether. Octavia colored, then recovered with a light laugh. Still copying phrases, I see. Lady Augusta always said you had a dangerous ear. Did she? Marianne asked. How kind of her to notice I was listening. A silence opened. It was small, but it belonged to Marianne. She had not fled. She had not apologized. She had not lowered her eyes. Across the room, Lady Augusta moved at last, gliding toward them with the grave patience of a woman arriving to correct a servant before guests could be troubled by the scene. Mary, she said. And this time the name carried warning beneath the softness. You must not overtire yourself. His Grace has been generous, but generosity can be misunderstood when a young woman forgets her place. Sebastian stepped forward. The movement was slight, but conversations died around them. Lady Augusta, I was under the impression Miss Fenn's place this evening was under Lady Beatrice's chaperonage. Lady Augusta curtsied. Your Grace is charitable to say so. No, I am accurate. Octavia looked down, biting back something unwise. Lady Augusta's gaze flicked again to the locket. Accuracy requires a full account. I fear Mary has a habit of becoming attached to objects and stories which do not belong to her. Marianne's fingers ached to close over the ivory. She did not allow them. Then perhaps the object should be examined by someone who remembers where it came from, she said. Lady Augusta's eyes sharpened. My dear, memory is a poor servant when imagination pays its wages. The sentence was elegant. It was also a blade. Marianne felt the old shame rise, thick and familiar. For one instant she was back in the attic room, hearing that her thoughts were fever, her hopes vanity. Her questions ingratitude. Then Sebastian's voice cut through the silence. I find memory more trustworthy than convenience. Lady Augusta turned to him with a smile that did not reach her eyes. Your Grace cannot wish to make a county assembly into an inquiry. I wish only to prevent it from becoming an ambush. The word traveled through the room. Ambush. Fans fluttered. Someone coughed. Lady Beatrice looked delighted in the smallest possible way. Marianne's heart beat hard enough to shake her breath, but she remained standing. Octavia, stung by the shift in attention, gave a soft laugh. Surely no one is ambushing Mary. We are only surprised to see her wearing a dead child's keepsake as if it were her own. The room went still. There it was, not rumor now, accusation. Marianne felt the floor seem to tilt beneath her. But she did not move, Sebastian did. He came to her side and offered his arm with perfect formality, as if Octavia had merely announced the opening of a dance. Miss Fenn, he said, his voice carrying to every corner nearby. Will you allow me the honor of escorting you around the room? Marianne stared at his gloved hand. To take it would be to invite more whispers. To refuse would be to retreat into the shape Lady Augusta had made for her. Her fingers trembled once, then she placed them upon his sleeve. The room drew breath as one body. Sebastian did not cover her hand with his. He did not possess the moment. He simply stood beside her, tall, severe, and immovable, making it impossible for anyone to pretend she was alone. They walked the length of the assembly room at a measured pace. Marianne felt every stare. The old instinct urged her to look at the floor, to become less visible, less troublesome, less alive. Instead, she looked ahead. At the far end of the room, a young woman who had once sent Marianne to fetch a shawl now curtsied uncertainly as they passed. An elderly gentleman bowed. Then another, not deeply, not warmly, but society cowardly and obedient, recognized power before it recognized truth. You need not thank me, Sebastian said quietly. I wasn't going to. The answer escaped before she could soften it. His mouth almost curved. Good. The tiny exchange steadied her more than any grand reassurance could have done. She will punish me for that, Marianne whispered. Not tonight. You can't know. No, he said. But I can make tonight difficult for her. She glanced up and found him watching the room, not with vanity, but with calculation sharpened by anger. You enjoy difficult things, Your Grace. Only when they deserve me. A fragile warmth touched her despite the fear. By the refreshment table, Lady Beatrice waited with a glass of lemonade and an expression that dared anyone to approach unwisely. Marianne accepted the glass and held it with both hands until the trembling eased. For several minutes, no one insulted her. That pause, brief as it was, felt like an unfamiliar country. Then Lady Augusta's voice rose behind them, smooth enough to silence the nearest circle. How unfortunate, she said. Not to Marianne directly, but to the room which was crueler. I had hoped to spare the girl, but if His Grace insists upon lending consequence to delusion, I may be forced to provide proof. Marianne turned slowly. Sebastian did as well. Octavia stood beside her aunt, pale with excitement. Lady Augusta's fan opened with a whisper. Tomorrow, she said, those who are concerned for truth shall see that Mary Fenn is not merely mistaken. She is a fraud. The word struck harder because it was spoken softly. The assembly room held its breath. Marianne felt Sebastian's arm become still beneath her hand, controlled power turned to ice. She did not faint. She did not run. She only touched the cracked locket and understood, with a certainty that chilled her more than rain, that Lady Augusta had been waiting for the moment when everyone would look. The proof Lady Augusta promised reached Alderwick Park before Marianne had finished her breakfast. It came not by private messenger, not by sealed letter, but by rumor, which in Hampshire traveled faster than any carriage and arrived with dirt already clinging to its wheels. Mrs. Pym heard it from the baker's boy. Harrow heard it from a groom who had stopped at the farrier. Lady Beatrice received the polished version from Mrs. Pemberton of Westbrook Lodge, who sent a note folded in great distress and unmistakable delight. By 10 o'clock, half the county believed Lady Augusta Kersey would produce evidence that Mary Fenn had plotted for months to pass herself off as a dead gentlewoman. By noon, the accusation had acquired a forged letter, a stolen keepsake, and an unnamed gentleman deceived by a pretty face. By two, the unnamed gentleman was openly understood to be the Duke of Bellemere. Marianne listened to Lady Beatrice, read the note aloud in the morning room, her hands folded in her lap so tightly that the knuckles showed pale beneath the skin. She had eaten only a few bites of toast. The locket rested outside her gown, visible because hiding it now would feel like surrender. Sebastian stood by the window, still as judgment. "She wastes no time," Lady Beatrice said, lowering the note. "Frightened women seldom do when fear wears pride," Sebastian replied. Marianne looked at him. "She is not frightened of me, no? I was useful to frighten, I was convenient to command. That is not the same as being dangerous." Lady Beatrice set the note down with a crisp tap. "My dear, anyone who can prove a lie has been told for 12 years is dangerous." Marianne's breath caught at the word prove. She did not yet have proof. She had memories, a cracked locket, a letter from a solicitor full of careful possibilities, and a duke who believed her more readily than she believed herself. Lady Augusta had chosen her battlefield well. Not a court. Not a solicitor's office. A public room. The place where a woman's reputation could be wounded before any fact had found its feet. "You do not have to go," Sebastian said. Marianne heard what he did not say. He could keep her here. He could send apologies. He could let his rank absorb the insult until his solicitor found better ground. It would be sensible. It would also leave Lady Augusta's words unchallenged in every drawing room in the county. "If I stay away, she will say I was afraid to answer. Let her. You can afford contempt, Your Grace." "I was raised on it." The quietness of her own voice startled her. Sebastian turned fully from the window. The room seemed to narrow around the distance between them. "Then do not mistake me. I do not suggest hiding because I doubt you. I suggest it because cruelty should not be allowed to choose the hour of your courage." For one aching moment, she wanted to accept. She wanted the blue chamber. The fire, Lady Beatrice's ruthless kindness, the safety of doors shut against the world. Then she remembered Octavia's voice, saying that a woman found in the road could not become a gentlewoman by wearing a dead girl's locket. She remembered every corridor at Kersey House where she had swallowed words until silence became the price of supper. "No," she said. "If Lady Augusta has chosen the hour, then I will choose how I stand in it." Lady Beatrice smiled without softness. "Excellent, then we shall dress with great care." The subscription rooms were crowded long before the musicians began. Lady Augusta had not called the gathering an inquiry. That would have been vulgar. It was a charitable planning meeting for the Winter Relief Fund, with tea, lists, donations, and enough county families in attendance to destroy a woman quietly while pretending to discuss blankets. Marianne entered between Lady Beatrice and Sebastian, wearing the same altered blue gown, her hair arranged simply, her face composed by effort rather than ease. The whispers began at once. This time they did not shrink from her. They came toward her like cold fingers. "There she is, Mary Fenn, the one from the road. Poor Duke. Did he truly believe it?" Lady Augusta stood near the front table with Octavia at her side. A small packet of folded paper lay beside the donation ledger. Marianne saw it and felt her stomach tighten. Sebastian saw it too. His jaw hardened, but he said nothing. Lady Beatrice leaned close. "Remember, my dear, they expect shame. Give them posture." Marianne almost laughed. The sound would have broken. So she kept it inside and stood straighter. Lady Augusta waited until the room had settled into full attention before she began. "I regret," she said, her voice pitched with exquisite restraint, "that a matter of private sorrow has entered public notice. Were only my own household involved, I would endure the inconvenience in silence. But when a respected nobleman's generosity is abused, and when a vulnerable young woman's delusions are encouraged by those who do not know her history, silence becomes irresponsible." No one breathed loudly. That was the cruelty of polite rooms. They made room for ruin. Sebastian took one step forward. Marianne's hand moved before she thought, and rested lightly against his sleeve, not to cling, to stop him. He looked down at her, and she gave the smallest shake of her head. "Not yet, let me hear it." He understood, though understanding cost him. Lady Augusta unfolded the paper. Mary Fenn came into my care as a child of uncertain background. She was fed, clothed, instructed, and given a place beyond what her birth could reasonably expect. Unfortunately, she developed an attachment to the effects of a deceased child, Miss Marianne Fairholt, and from that attachment grew a dangerous fantasy. Octavia lowered her eyes at exactly the proper angle for pity. Marianne watched her and felt fear become something sharper. Lady Augusta lifted the paper. I had hoped never to reveal this, but Mary's own hand shows the nature of her ambition. This note was found among her possessions after she fled Kersey House. A murmur passed through the room. Lady Augusta read, "One day they will not call me Mary. One day I shall wear the locket openly, and they shall all be forced to say I was born above them." The words struck Marianne first as nonsense, then as violation. She had never written them. Yet the shape of the handwriting, when Lady Augusta held the page for those nearest to see, was horribly familiar. The slant, the narrow loops. The careful discipline beaten into every letter by years of copying accounts and invitations at Lady Augusta's table. Someone had made her own hand accuse her. "That is not mine," Marianne said. Her voice sounded too soft in the room. Octavia's head lifted. "Oh, Mary, don't make this worse." Lady Beatrice's cane touched the floor. "Miss Kersey, you will not address my guest as though she were a scolded child," Lady Augusta sighed. "You see how easily sympathy is drawn to performance. Mary has always possessed a talent for seeming wounded when corrected." The word "corrected" moved through Marianne like a key turned in an old lock. Corrected. That was what Lady Augusta called every erasure. Her name corrected, her memory corrected, her posture, her hunger, her tears, her letters, her very face when it showed too much light. Sebastian's voice entered the room, low and carrying. "You will choose your next words carefully, Lady Augusta." The room froze, Lady Augusta's face whitened by one degree. "Your Grace, I speak only from duty." "No. You speak from confidence that no one has asked what duty required of you when a child with a name became a dependent without one." The silence after that was not polite. It was stunned. Marianne felt every eye move from Lady Augusta to her. For one wild second she wanted to vanish. Then Lady Augusta recovered. "A duke's indignation is powerful, but it is not evidence. This unfortunate young woman was found wandering in the road, wearing an object that never belonged to her, after leaving the only home that had tolerated her instability. If Your Grace chooses to give that circumstance romance, I cannot prevent it. But I can warn this room. A woman found in the road cannot become a gentlewoman by wearing a dead girl's locket." Octavia's lips parted in satisfaction. The sentence landed exactly where it was meant to land. Marianne felt it hit the room and change shape. Not only accusation, contagion. Faces that had been curious became guarded. Women who had pitied her now wondered whether pity had made them foolish. A gentleman near the table looked away as if embarrassment itself might stain. Sebastian moved then, not violently, not quickly, but with such controlled authority that the nearest people stepped back. "Enough." Lady Augusta lifted her chin. "Truth often feels unkind to those who depend on illusion. Then let us speak truth plainly." His gaze swept the room. "Miss Fenn, as she is presently known, was found ill upon the road. She was brought to my house, attended by a physician, and placed under the chaperonage of Lady Beatrice Anstruther. She has not solicited my protection by artifice. She has not asked for rank, money, or consequence. She has asked only not to be returned to a household that appears remarkably eager to recover her, and remarkably reluctant to explain why." Lady Augusta's fan trembled once. Marianne saw it. So did Sebastian. He continued, "Until the matter of her identity is resolved, she remains a guest at Alderwick Park, under my protection." A sound went through the room, half gasp, half whisper. The Duke of Bellmere had not merely defended her. He had placed his name between Marianne and public contempt. For a heartbeat, relief rose so strongly that she nearly weakened beneath it. Then the cost followed, "under my protection." The words saved her from the room, but they also moved the story from Lady Augusta's control to his. No one had asked whether she wanted her truth carried by a duke's authority before she could hold it in her own hands. Lady Beatrice looked at her sharply, as if she had heard that inner fracture. Sebastian offered his arm. Miss Fenn. He meant to lead her out before Lady Augusta could strike again. It was wise, it was generous, it was also unbearable. Marianne took his arm because refusal would feed the wolves. But as they crossed the room, she heard the whispers change. His protection. Poor creature. Perhaps he means to settle money on her, or send her away quietly. She kept her face still. Her fingers rested on Sebastian's sleeve, trembling only once. Outside the subscription room, in the narrow passage where the noise dulled behind the door, she withdrew her hand. Sebastian turned to her at once. You are safe. She looked at him. And the ache in her chest became words before fear could stop them. Am I? His expression changed. Marianne. The sound of the name in his voice nearly undid her. You saved me from them, she said. I know that. Then why do you look at me as if I have harmed you? Because you told them where I stand before you asked me where I wished to stand. He went very still. The anger that had made him powerful in the room vanished, leaving something more exposed and more difficult. Behind them, the door opened a crack, and murmurs spilled out. Hungry for the next version of the tale. Marianne touched the locket, not hiding it, only holding herself together. Do not make a sanctuary into another locked room. Sebastian did not answer at once. For the first time since she had known him, the Duke of Belmere looked as though power had failed to give him the right words. By dawn, Sebastian had already chosen the safest course. And that was the first mistake. He made it in the library at Alderwick Park, while the household still slept, with Lady Augusta's accusation lying in memory like ash over every polished surface. The county subscription rooms had emptied the previous night in a storm of whispers, and though no one had dared insult Marianne openly, after the Duke of Belmere claimed her protection, society did not need courage to do harm. It needed only repetition. By breakfast, the forged note would be described as damning. By luncheon, Marianne would be an adventuress. By evening, even those who doubted Lady Augusta would begin to pity Sebastian for being deceived, which was only another way of condemning the woman he had meant to defend. He stood at his writing desk, with a letter half finished to Lady Honoria Strake, his widowed cousin in Bath. A woman of unimpeachable propriety and sufficient stubbornness to shelter a queen, if she decided the queen had been badly treated. Bath was respectable. Bath was distant. Bath would remove Marianne from Hampshire eyes until Mr. Penrose could gather records and witnesses. It was logical. It was clean. It was also a decision made without the person most wounded by it. Sebastian knew that, as soon as Lady Beatrice entered the library without knocking, wrapped in a dark shawl and wearing the expression she reserved for male stupidity in expensive coats. You look like a man preparing to do something sensible and unforgivable, she said. He sealed the letter before answering. Marianne cannot remain here while Lady Augusta poisons the county against her. Marianne, Lady Beatrice lifted one silver brow. Last night you defended Miss Fenn before a room, and this morning you exile Marianne in private. How efficient. I am not exiling her, no? What do you call sending a woman to Bath before she has finished learning whether her own name belongs to her? Protection. Men do love that word when it saves them the trouble of asking. Sebastian set the seal down with more force than necessary. If she stays, every neighbor within 20 miles will make her story their entertainment. Yes. And if she leaves by your arrangement, Lady Augusta will say she fled because she was exposed. He looked toward the window where the lawns lay pale under a thin mist. If she is ruined here before the truth is ready, there may be nothing left to restore. Truth is not parcel, Sebastian. It does not arrive only when solicitors wrap it properly. He turned back. What would you have me do? Lady Beatrice's answer was quiet. Ask her. Neither of them heard the door open. Marianne stood just inside the threshold, dressed in the blue gown from the assembly. Though the ribbon at one sleeve had been tied incorrectly, and her hair had been arranged with less care than usual, she looked as if she had not slept. The cracked locket rested outside her bodice. Her hand lay over it, not hiding, but holding. "Ask me what," she said. Sebastian went still. For 1 second the room held all that he had not meant her to hear. Then her gaze moved to the sealed letter on the desk. She understood. He saw the moment in her face, not as drama, but as the small withdrawal of trust. "Bath," she said, "you were going to send me away." "To a safe house," he replied. "To my cousin, Lady Honoria Strake. She is beyond Lady Augusta's influence. How fortunate for me that you found a safer shelf." "That is not what this is, isn't it?" The question was soft, and because it was soft, it wounded more precisely. Lady Beatrice did not intervene. Sebastian forced his voice down. "I meant to tell you after breakfast, after the arrangements were complete. I meant to spare you another public attack." "And what did you mean to spare yourself?" He did not answer at once. Marianne's eyes shone, but no tear fell. "You said no one would send me anywhere until I was strong enough to choose. Did that promise expire when my presence became inconvenient?" "Never." The word came hard and immediate. "Your presence is not inconvenient." "Then why am I being moved like evidence someone has not yet sorted?" Sebastian drew breath, then stopped. She had used the word he had earned. Evidence. The locket in a drawer. Her name in a letter. Her body placed where safety looked best to the powerful. "I was wrong," he said. The admission silenced the room. Marianne looked startled, almost unwilling to hear it. "That does not change the fact that Lady Augusta has turned the county against you," he continued. "It changes what I ask next. Where do you wish to go?" Her hand closed around the locket. "Fairholt Parish." Lady Beatrice's eyes sharpened. "The parish church near Fairholt Grange." "Yes. Mr. Penrose wrote there was no burial record. If there was a baptism record, a christening, anything. I want to see whether my name was once written, where Lady Augusta could not command the ink." Sebastian felt resistance rise, born of fear, not doubt. Fairholt Parish lay almost 12 miles away. Near Kersey influence and nearer old secrets than comfort allowed. "Marianne, that may not be safe." "Then say so. Do not dress command as concern." He bowed his head slightly. "It may not be safe. I will go with Lady Beatrice, if she is willing." Lady Beatrice gave a short laugh. "My dear, I have been willing since last Tuesday for almost anything that annoys Lady Augusta." Marianne almost smiled, but the strain held it back. She looked at Sebastian. "You may come if you can come without deciding for me." The condition entered him like a deserved rebuke. "I will come," he said, "and I will not pull you back unless you ask me to. Not even if you think I am wrong. I may tell you I think you are wrong. That is allowed. But I will not make the choice yours in words and mine in action." For the first time since entering, some of the hurt in her face loosened, not gone. Trust did not return simply because a man finally learned the cost of mishandling it, but it shifted. That was enough for mourning. They left within the hour in Lady Beatrice's carriage. Because it attracted less notice than the Belmere crest, and because Lady Beatrice declared she would not be reduced to decorative chaperonage, while men conducted all useful motion. Sebastian rode behind on horseback, close enough to protect, far enough not to seem as if he commanded the journey. Marianne watched him once through the carriage glass as they passed the wet hedgerows beyond Alderwick Park. His dark coat cut a severe shape against the grey road. He did not look toward her window. Somehow, that restraint comforted her, more than vigilance would have done. Fairholt Parish appeared near midday, a small stone church set beyond a yew-lined path, with the old rectory beside it, and the roofs of the village gathered below like a cluster of tired brown caps. Beyond the churchyard, half hidden by trees, stood a distant pair of gateposts crowned by stone falcons. Marianne saw them and lost her breath. The memory did not arrive as a grand revelation. It came as a child's hand reaching upward, as a wheel crunching gravel, as a woman saying, "Look, little one, the falcons are watching us home." Lady Beatrice touched her arm. "Do you know them?" Marianne nodded once. Speech would have broken something. The vicar, Mr. Toller, was a thin man with anxious eyes and ink on one cuff. He received Lady Beatrice with respect, Sebastian with alarm, and Marianne with a searching look that made her feel both exposed and almost remembered. They sat in the vestry, where old registers rested in a locked chest, and the room smelled of paper dust and damp stone. "Fairholt," Mr. Toller murmured, after Lady Beatrice explained enough to make the request proper without making it theatrical. "Yes, there was sorrow there. Fever took the house hard. We wish to see the baptism register for the year of Miss Marianne Fairholt's birth," Sebastian said. Marianne looked at him. He had said Miss Marianne Fairholt without hesitation, the vicar noticed. His hands moved more slowly as he opened the chest. "I was not vicar then, Your Grace. My predecessor kept the records, though not always with the discipline one would wish." He laid a heavy book on the table. The leather cover had cracked at the spine. He turned the pages with care. Names passed beneath his finger. Infants christened. Fathers named. Mothers recorded. Lives entered in ink because someone had stood before God and witnesses and said, "This child belongs to the world." Marianne leaned forward, despite herself. Then Mr. Toller stopped. His face changed. On the page before them, a strip had been cut or torn cleanly from the lower half. Not by age, not by accident, a neat wound in the register. "That is the year," he said. Lady Beatrice's cane struck the floor softly. "How convenient." Sebastian's voice was quiet. "When was this done?" "I cannot say." The vicar looked miserable. "I have seen damage in old registers. But this is not ordinary wear." Marianne stared at the missing space. She had imagined finding her name. She had imagined disappointment. She had not imagined absence carved into proof itself. Her locket felt suddenly heavy. "Someone came before us," she said. Mr. Toller glanced toward the closed vestry door. "A man called this morning. He asked whether loose pages from old registers might be purchased for a family archive. I refused him, of course. It was an improper request." Sebastian's eyes lifted. "Describe him. Tall brown coat. A scar near the chin." He did not give a name. Lady Beatrice looked at Sebastian. "Kersey House has a groom with a scar near the chin." The room grew colder without any change in the fireless grate. Marianne looked at the torn page, then beyond the vestry window to the stone falcons blurred by rain. Lady Augusta had not merely prepared an accusation. She had sent someone to buy the past before Marianne could touch it. Sebastian stepped closer, stopping beside her, not in front of her. "What do you wish to do now?" he asked. The question trembled through her, more deeply than any command could have done. Marianne placed one hand flat on the register beside the torn edge. The paper was cool beneath her palm. Her voice, when it came, was low but clear. "Find someone who remembers what was written here." Mr. Toller remembered the nurse only after Marianne had stopped, hoping he would. The vicar stood beside the torn parish register with his ink-stained fingers resting on the damaged page, looking less like a man guarding records than one who had just discovered how easily records could be made to fail. "Mrs. Elspeth Wren," he said at last. "She served at Fairholt Grange when Mr. Fairholt and his lady were alive. Nurse first, then sickroom attendant during the fever. I had not thought of her because she left service years ago." Marianne's hand remained flat beside the missing portion of the page. She did not trust herself to lift it. "Is she still living?" "Yes. In a cottage beyond the old mill lane, a mile and a half from here. Perhaps less if the road has not flooded." Mr. Toller glanced at Sebastian, then at Lady Beatrice. "She is elderly, but her memory is said to be sharp where the Fairholts are concerned. She was devoted to them. Devoted." The word entered Marianne like warmth through a locked door. Someone had been devoted to the people whose names had been turned into a warning at Kersey House. Someone might remember without calling memory vanity. Sebastian did not move in front of her or decide for her. He waited at her side, his face severe and careful. The restraint mattered. Since the morning in the library, he had asked before acting. He had also looked as if the habit injured his pride, which made Marianne trust it more. Men who found humility comfortable rarely possessed much of it. "Do you wish to go now?" he asked. Marianne looked at the torn register. Then through the vestry window toward the blur of stone falcons near the distant gates. Lady Augusta had tried to buy the page before Marianne could read it. That alone was proof of fear, but not enough to stand against a room full of polite disbelief. Yes, she said, before anyone else remembers to forget. Lady Beatrice rose with the aid of her cane. A wise sentence. Let us put it into motion before my knees begin to form political objections. Mr. Toller offered to send a boy ahead, but Marianne refused gently. She had spent too much of her life, announced before, entering rooms where others had already decided her place. This time she wanted to arrive before the story did. They took Lady Beatrice's carriage along a narrow lane bordered by hedges, silvered with rain. Sebastian rode close behind, until Lady Beatrice wrapped her cane against the carriage roof, and called through the small window, Your Grace, if you hover any nearer, my horse will think itself married to yours. He fell back by several yards. Marianne almost smiled. It did not last, but it loosened something in her chest. The cottage stood near a dry stone wall and a leaning apple tree, small, neat, and whitewashed, with rosemary by the door, and a strip of linen hanging beneath a porch to escape the damp. The woman who opened to them was bent with age, but not with fear. Mrs. Elspeth Wren had white hair drawn into a knot, dark eyes bright as polished buttons, and hands that trembled only when idle. When Lady Beatrice gave her name, the old woman curtsied. When Sebastian gave his, she looked startled, but not overwhelmed. When Marianne stepped into view, Mrs. Wren gripped the doorframe. Mercy, she whispered. Marianne could not breathe. No one had looked at her like that before, as if her face had struck a bell in an old room. Mrs. Wren, Lady Beatrice said quietly, this young woman seeks information about the Fairholt family. The nurse did not take her eyes from Marianne. Information? Her voice shook. That is not information standing on my step. Marianne's hand rose to the locket. Do you know me? Mrs. Wren pressed one hand to her mouth, then lowered it with visible effort. Come inside, child. Come inside before the wet gets into your bones. Child. The word almost undid her. Not girl. Not dependent. Not creature. Child inside. The cottage smelled of tea, beeswax, and dried lavender. A small fire burned in the grate. Sebastian remained near the door until Mrs. Wren, after one measuring look, said, If you are here to frighten her with rank, Your Grace, you may wait outside with the rain. Lady Beatrice laughed outright. Mrs. Wren, I begin to like you excessively. Sebastian bowed. I am here because she permitted me to come. Mrs. Wren considered him, then nodded once. Then sit where she can see the door. He did. Marianne noticed. The nurse brought no ceremony to the moment. She set tea on the table, forgot to pour it, and came to stand before Marianne with both hands clenched in her apron. May I see it? Marianne knew what she meant. Slowly she lifted the locket from her breast. Mrs. Wren did not touch it. She bent close, eyes narrowing, and her breath caught when she saw the crack across the ivory. Violets, she whispered. Your mother chose violets because they were the first flowers you crushed in your little fist and refused to release. You were 9 months old and angry, as a duchess denied the crown jewels. A sound left Marianne. It was not a laugh, it was not a sob. It was the breaking of a silence that had lasted too many years. My mother, Mrs. Celia Fairholt, sweet voice, terrible handwriting, loved you beyond sense. Mrs. Wren's eyes shone. And your father, Mr. Alaric, said you would command Parliament if only Parliament had the wisdom to admit babies. Lady Beatrice turned her face aside. Sebastian did not. He watched Marianne as if the truth had weight, and he meant to help bear it without touching it. Lady Augusta said they died in disgrace, Marianne said. Lady Augusta Kersey would call sunrise improper if it did not ask her permission. Mrs. Wren's mouth tightened. Your parents died of fever within 4 days of each other. There was grief, not disgrace. Marianne held the locket harder. And I, Mrs. Wren's face changed. You were ill, so ill I thought my heart would stop from watching yours fight. But you lived. The room seemed to move around Marianne. She reached for the back of a chair, but Sebastian did not spring forward. His hand shifted once on his knee, then stilled. He remembered. Ask. Wait, let her choose. There is a mark, Mrs. Wren said softly. On your left wrist. You caught it on the nursery grate when you were small, because you tried to rescue a wooden horse that had fallen too close to the fire. A tiny crescent scar. I cried more than you did. Marianne looked down at her glove. The scar beneath it had always been there, pale and curved, another thing Lady Augusta had dismissed as proof of clumsiness. Her fingers trembled as she worked the buttons. One resisted, then another. She wanted suddenly to fail at the simple act, to leave the glove on and keep the world as terrible but known. Instead, she drew it free and turned her wrist upward. The scar showed faintly against her skin. Mrs. Wren covered her mouth. "Miss Marianne," she said, and this time the name was not question but recognition. Marianne swayed. Sebastian rose halfway, then stopped. The restraint cost him. She saw it. She saw his fear and his obedience to her dignity, and something in her heart answered, before caution could silence it. She extended her ungloved hand toward him. Only then did he cross the small space and take it. His grasp was warm, steady, and careful, as if he held not possession but permission. "I am here," he said. "I know." Her voice was barely sound. "That is why I reached." Mrs. Wren wiped her eyes with her apron, then hurried to a small chest near the hearth. "I kept something, foolish perhaps, but grief makes thieves of old nurses." She opened the chest and took out a folded cloth. Inside lay a faded violet ribbon, frayed at the ends. "This was tied through the locket chain when you were baptized. Your mother said ivory was too pale for such a fierce child, so she added color." Marianne touched the ribbon with one finger. A memory came, brief and bright. A woman laughing, a purple blur. Sun on a basin painted with flowers. She bowed her head, not in shame this time, but because the room had filled too suddenly with a life stolen from her. "What happened after the fever?" Sebastian asked. His voice was low, but the question held an edge. Mrs. Wren looked at him, and old anger sharpened her face. Lady Augusta came after the funeral with her husband's papers and talk of duty. She said the child must be removed from the infected house. "I was fevered myself by then, weak as a rag. I begged to go with Miss Marianne." Lady Augusta said a nurse in mourning was of no use, and that arrangements had been made. 3 weeks later, word came that the child had died after all. "No body shown to me, no grave I could find. Only a statement, neat as a church notice, that Marianne Fairholt had been taken by fever." "And you believed it?" Marianne asked. Mrs. Wren flinched. "I was told by gentlefolk with seals and signatures. I was poor, I was ill, I had no right to demand they open doors." She looked at Marianne with grief-stripped bare. "Forgive me," Marianne's answer came before thought. "No." The old woman's face crumpled. Marianne reached for her with the hand Sebastian had released at once. "No, I mean there is nothing to forgive. You remembered me." Mrs. Wren bent over Marianne's hand and kissed it as if it belonged to the child she had lost. No one spoke for several seconds. Even Lady Beatrice was silent. Then hooves sounded outside. Not passing. Stopping. Sebastian turned toward the window. His expression hardened. A servant from the nearby inn stood beyond the gate, hat in hand, speaking to the coachman. Minutes later he was brought to the cottage door, with a folded paper sealed in dark wax. "Begging pardon, Your Grace," the boy said, breathless.
"A gentleman at the inn bade me bring this, Sir Lionel Craik.
He says it concerns the lady's welfare, and must be answered before nightfall." Marianne felt Sebastian's stillness before he took the paper. "Sir Lionel, Lady Augusta's ally." The man whose name had shadowed Kersey House accounts and whispered conversations for years. Sebastian broke the seal and read. His face revealed nothing, which told Marianne enough. "What does it say?" she asked. He looked at her before answering, and this time he did not soften the truth by hiding it. "Sir Lionel claims you are unstable, improperly influenced, and unfit to manage your own affairs. He has a statement prepared at the inn for you to sign, renouncing the name Fairholt, and acknowledging yourself as Mary Fenn." The cottage air turned cold around Marianne. The violet ribbon lay on the table between them, fragile and undeniable. Mrs. Wren whispered a prayer. Lady Beatrice Kane struck the floor once. Marianne looked at the locket, the scar on her bare wrist. The old nurse who remembered, and the Duke who had finally learned to stand beside rather than before her. Her fear did not leave, but it no longer filled the room. "Then," she said, closing her hand around the faded ribbon, "we should not keep Sir Lionel waiting. Sir Lionel Craik, had chosen the largest private parlor at the Fairholt Arms, which revealed more about his fear than his confidence. A man certain of his right did not require two windows, three candles before noon, a polished table, and a chair placed so that anyone entering must face him as if standing before judgment. Marianne noticed all of it when she crossed the threshold with Lady Beatrice beside her, Sebastian behind her, and the faded violet ribbon folded in her reticule like a small piece of resurrected life. She had expected Sir Lionel to look monstrous. He did not. That was the first discomfort. He was a tall gentleman of perhaps 50, well-dressed in dark brown, with silver at his temples, a narrow scar near his chin, and the smooth, tired face of a man who had spent years turning other people's emergencies into his own advantage. His smile, when he bowed, was not warm enough to be false. It was worse. It was practiced enough to pass. "Miss Fenn," he said, "how relieved I am to find you in reasonable company at last." Sebastian moved half a step. Marianne felt it rather than saw it. The air around him tightened. Before he could speak, she answered, "My name is the matter under discussion, Sir Lionel. You may begin more carefully." Lady Beatrice's cane touched the floor once. A quiet punctuation. Sir Lionel's smile thinned. "Very well, Miss Fairholt, if that courtesy eases you for the moment." "Courtesy does not ease me. Accuracy might." Something flared in his eyes and vanished. He gestured toward the table, where papers lay arranged beside an inkwell and a pen. Lady Augusta Kersey sat near the hearth in a traveling dress of dark green, gloved hands folded, face pale with self-command. Octavia stood at the window, looking out toward the yard as if she wished to seem above the ugliness she had helped create. Her eagerness betrayed her. She turned too quickly when Marianne entered, and the little triumph in her face had not yet learned to hide itself. "Mary," Lady Augusta said softly. "I had hoped you would come quietly." Marianne walked to the far side of the table but did not sit. "I have come clearly. Clarity is precisely what we offer." Sir Lionel tapped the top paper. "A simple statement, a necessary correction. You acknowledge yourself as Mary Fenn, formerly dependent of Kersey House. You admit that certain fancies regarding the late Marianne Fairholt arose from confusion, sentiment, and improper encouragement. You agree to make no claim upon the Fairholt name, fortune, or effects. In return, Lady Augusta is prepared to show mercy." The word mercy fell upon the table like something spoiled. Marianne looked at the paper without touching it. Her own name was not written there. That, too, was deliberate. Mary Fenn appeared again and again, a cage made of ink. "Mercy," Lady Beatrice repeated. "How generous. Does it come with a chain, or must she provide her own?" Sir Lionel inclined his head. "Lady Beatrice, I respect your position, but you have been misled by distress. The young woman is not wicked." "I have never suggested wickedness. She is impressionable, nervous, and dangerously susceptible to ideas beyond her station." Sebastian's voice cut in, cold and level. "You will not diagnose a woman because her existence inconveniences your accounts." Sir Lionel turned toward him at last. "Your Grace, with respect, your involvement has already made a delicate matter almost irreparable. A duke's protection may flatter a vulnerable mind. It may also expose you to ridicule if the truth becomes public." "You believe ridicule frightens me?" "No. I believe scandal touches more than the man who invites it." His gaze moved to Marianne, then to Lady Augusta. "This statement protects everyone. It prevents a public humiliation in London, which Lady Augusta has been urged, with difficulty, to avoid. It spares Miss Fenn the harsher consequences of persisting in delusion. It prevents questions of improper influence during her stay under your roof." Marianne heard the old trap close its teeth, not directly. Politely, if she refused, she was unstable. If Sebastian defended her, he was compromised. If Lady Beatrice stood beside her, she was misled by sentiment. Truth had been crowded into a corner and told to behave. "And if I do not sign," she asked. Sir Lionel sighed. It was a careful sound, full of regret he did not feel. "Then, the matter must proceed without your cooperation. A physician known to Lady Augusta is prepared to certify that your nervous condition renders you unfit to manage your own affairs at present. No one wishes to confine you cruelly, but supervision may be necessary until these fantasies pass. Sebastian's hand struck the back of a chair, not hard enough to break anything, hard enough to silence every breath in the room. You will withdraw that threat, Sir Lionel's face tightened. It is not a threat, it is a precaution. It is cowardice wearing a physician's coat. Sebastian, Marianne said. He stopped, his gaze came to her, still bright with anger. She knew what he could do. He could destroy the moment by force of rank. He could make Sir Lionel retreat. Make Lady Augusta tremble. Make every servant in the inn remember that a duke's displeasure was a weather system of its own. Part of her wanted it, the tired part. The part that had slept cold and eaten little, and learned to endure correction in silence, but another part, newly awakened by a ribbon, a scar, and an old woman's voice saying, Miss Marianne, new rescue could not be the whole of justice. Let me answer, she said. Marianne, he spoke her name softly now, not as possession, as warning. Please, that single word changed him. His hand left the chair. He stepped back, not far, but enough. Lady Augusta saw the exchange and misread it as weakness. Mary, you are overwrought. His Grace has been kind. But kindness from gentlemen is easily misunderstood by girls who have not been raised to receive it properly. Marianne turned to her. You did not raise me to receive kindness at all. Octavia made a small sound at the window. Lady Augusta's mouth tightened. I raised you to be useful. No, you trained me to be grateful for erasure. The words shook after they left her. But they did not break. Marianne picked up the statement. The paper was thick and expensive. She thought of the torn parish register, the scratched initials in the Latin primer. The letters burned before she could read them. She thought of Mrs. Wren saying her mother loved violets, because Marianne had crushed them in her fist as a baby. She thought of a gate with stone falcons and a woman's voice saying, China was not worth tears. Then she read the statement from beginning to end. It was worse than she expected because it was gentle. It did not call her liar. It invited her to call herself mistaken. It did not accuse her of theft. It asked her to surrender what had already been stolen. You want me to sign myself into the person you invented, she said. I want you to stop suffering from a delusion that others have cruelly encouraged, Lady Augusta replied. Did my mother have violets painted on her basin? Silence. Lady Augusta blinked once. What? Mrs. Wren remembers it. She remembers my locket. She remembers the scar on my wrist. She remembers my mother's name. A retired servant's ramblings prove nothing, Sir Lionel said quickly. Then why did your groom try to buy the torn page from the parish register this morning? The question passed through the parlor like a flame under paper. Octavia turned from the window. Lady Augusta's face remained composed, but the life went out of her eyes. Sir Lionel recovered first. I know nothing of such an errand. Then your servants act with remarkable imagination, Lady Beatrice said. A contagious quality in Kersey households, it seems. Sebastian looked at Sir Lionel with a stillness more dangerous than movement. You have miscalculated. This is no longer a matter of a frightened woman's word against yours. Sir Lionel lifted his chin. Careful, Your Grace. If this reaches London before you can shape it, society will not see a noble rescue. It will see a duke housing a nameless young woman, parading her at assemblies and encouraging her to pursue a dead heiress's fortune. Lady Augusta has friends in Mayfair, so do I. Marianne looked down at the statement again. Her hands had steadied. That surprised her most. No, she said. No, Lady Augusta echoed. No. She tore the statement once. The sound was small, final. Octavia gasped as if the paper had been flesh, though no one had been harmed except the lie. Marianne tore it again. Then once more, until the name Mary Fenn lay broken in pieces upon the table. I will not sign myself out of existence. No one spoke, not Lady Augusta, not Sir Lionel, not Sebastian. The room had become too honest for speech. Marianne placed the torn papers beside the inkwell with care. If I am wrong, I will learn it standing. If I am right, you will learn it in front of every person you meant to use against me. Lady Augusta rose slowly. Do not mistake one theatrical gesture for victory. Tomorrow evening, Countess of Eversholt opens her Mayfair drawing room to a select circle. I had hoped to spare you. I shall not make that mistake again. You have mistaken many things, Marianne said. Begin counting there. Octavia's face flushed. Sir Lionel gathered his gloves, composure cracked but not gone. Very well, London shall hear the truth. Sebastian stepped forward then, not to shield Marianne, but to stand beside her. Yes, he said, it shall. Sir Lionel's gaze flicked between them, and for the first time Marianne saw it clearly. Not merely anger. Fear, the kind that counts ledgers in the dark. Lady Augusta swept toward the door, Octavia following, her pink ribbons trembling. At the threshold, Lady Augusta turned back. Mary, when this is finished, remember that I offered mercy. Marianne touched the locket at her throat. When this is finished, remember that I refused it. The door closed behind them. The parlor seemed larger once they were gone, as though the air had been returned. Lady Beatrice exhaled. I have attended duels with less satisfaction. Sebastian did not smile. He looked at Marianne, and all the power he had held back showed, in the effort of holding it still. You should not have had to do that. No, she said, but I did. Are you afraid? The answer would once have humiliated her. Now it felt like a truth she owned. Yes. Do you still want to go to Mayfair? Marianne looked at the torn paper, the locket, and the closed door through which Lady Augusta had carried 12 years of lies toward London. Yes, she said. But not to be defended, Sebastian's eyes remained on hers. Then why? To speak. For a moment, his face softened in a way she had no defense against. Then I will listen, he said. And because he said only that, because he did not promise to conquer or command or rescue the story from her hands, Marianne believed him. London received Marianne with fog, lamps, and the sensation that every window in Mayfair had learned her name before she arrived. The journey from Hampshire had taken most of the day, broken only by changes of horses and Lady Beatrice's firm insistence that anxiety was no excuse for refusing tea. Mrs. Wren had come with them, wrapped in a plain black cloak and clutching a small cloth bundle that held the faded violet ribbon as if it were a relic from a chapel. Mr. Toller had also agreed to travel, pale and uneasy but resolute, carrying his written account of the torn parish register. Mr. Penrose, the solicitor, was already in London, summoned by Sebastian with a message so brief that even Lady Beatrice had called it ducal thunder bolded into paper. By the time their carriages turned into Grosvenor Square, the sky had darkened to a smoky purple, and the houses rose tall and pale behind iron railings. Marianne looked from the carriage window and saw nothing of wonder, only judgment dressed in stone. Countess of Eversholt's house shone with candles. It was not a ballroom. No musicians waited. No dance floor promised distraction. This was worse. A drawing room was more intimate, and intimacy made cruelty quieter. The people invited would not pretend accident had brought them. They had come to witness a woman corrected, exposed, or restored, depending on whose truth survived the evening. Lady Beatrice watched Marianne's face in the dim carriage light. You are allowed to be afraid. Marianne touched the cracked ivory locket at her throat. The faded violet ribbon lay folded inside her glove, not hidden from shame, but kept close until needed. I know. Do you wish to turn back? No. Good. I should have been disappointed if you had said yes. But I would have turned the carriage around, while insulting everyone involved. Marianne almost smiled. Across from her, Mrs. Wren reached out and patted her knee with a nurse's old authority. You were a fierce babe. Do not let silk people frighten you. Silk people, Lady Beatrice repeated. Mrs. Wren, I shall keep that phrase. The carriage stopped. For a moment, no one moved. Then the door opened, and cold London air entered. Sebastian waited at the foot of the steps in evening black, his face composed, his eyes on Marianne alone. He had ridden ahead to speak with Mr. Penrose and the Countess. He had not sent instructions back. He had not arranged her entrance without asking. When she stepped down, he offered his hand not as a command, but as assistance. She accepted. His fingers closed around hers for only the time needed to steady her, no longer. That restraint made her heart ache more than boldness would have done. Mr. Penrose is inside, he said. So is Mr. Toller. The Countess understands that you will speak when you choose. Marianne looked up at the bright windows, and Lady Augusta already arrived. Of course she is. Sir Lionel too. Miss Kersey has not left her aunt's side. Lady Beatrice descended behind Marianne with her cane. Naturally, Mischief likes an audience. Sebastian's gaze remained on Marianne. There is something else. Her hand tightened once in her glove. Tell me. Octavia Kersey has been seen with a locket. Mr. Penrose believes they may try to confuse the object itself. Marianne felt the old coldness move through her, but it did not conquer. A false locket, perhaps. Then they must be more frightened than I knew. Yes, she looked at him then, truly looked. The Duke of Bellemere, who could have filled the doorway with rank and made the evening his contest, stood waiting for her choice. You could stop this, she said. I could make it difficult. That is not what I asked. A faint shadow crossed his face. Yes, I could stop it. I could insist the Countess dismiss the guests. I could have Lady Augusta's carriage turned away. I could use influence until every coward in that room pretended never to have doubted you. But you would not be able to make them know. No, the answer was bare. I could only make them obey. The distinction settled between them, like a promise kept late but kept. Marianne drew one breath, then another. Then do not stop it. I will not. Do not speak first. I will not. Do not ask me afterward whether I am certain. His mouth tightened, not in anger, but in recognition. I will not. Lady Beatrice made an approving sound. Excellent. A duke taking instruction. London may not survive the shock. Marianne's nerves almost broke into laughter. Instead, she lifted her chin. There is one thing you may ask. Sebastian's eyes changed. What is that? You may ask what you asked before. For a moment he did not understand. Then he did, and the severity in him softened so quietly it seemed meant only for her. Miss Fairholt, he said, using the name before the room had granted it. May I stand beside you? The words struck deeper than any declaration could have. He did not ask to lead. He did not ask to rescue. He asked to stand. Marianne felt Mrs. Wren behind her, carrying memory. Lady Beatrice beside her, carrying reputation. Mr. Toller and Mr. Penrose inside, carrying records and consequence. Sebastian before her, carrying power with both hands closed until she asked him to use it. Yes, she said. You may. The footman opened the door. Warmth, wax light, and voices rolled out. The Countess of Eversholt's drawing room was long, high-ceilinged, and crowded just enough to make every whisper personal. Mirrors doubled the candles. Gilt chairs lined the walls. A tea table stood untouched near the windows. No one had come for tea. The Countess herself came forward, an elegant woman in deep plum silk. Her silver hair arranged beneath diamonds, too restrained to be vulgar. She greeted Lady Beatrice, first Sebastian second, then turned to Marianne without hesitation. Miss Fenn, she said, careful and neutral, but not unkind. You are welcome in my house. It was not the name Marianne wanted. It was also not an insult. Thank you, my lady. Across the room, Lady Augusta stood near the mantel, wearing black satin and an expression of injured duty. Sir Lionel Craik stood close enough to suggest alliance, not affection. Octavia, in pale green this time, held a small reticule too tightly. Marianne saw the shape within it. Oval. Hard. A locket, perhaps. Lady Beatrice saw it too. Her cane shifted once against the carpet. Sebastian did not miss the movement. Neither did Mr. Penrose, who stood near the bookcase with papers in a leather folio, and the sober face of a man who preferred ink to drama. Mr. Toller waited beside him, hands clasped, looking as if he would rather face a sermon to an empty church than this room full of titled suspicion. Mrs. Wren remained near Lady Beatrice, small and plain among silks. But her eyes were bright with memory. The conversations dwindled as Marianne entered fully. It was like walking into water. Sound closed over her, then thinned. Lady Augusta let the silence ripen before she moved. She did not rush, she had never needed to. Her cruelty wore patience the way other women wore jewels. Countess, she said, I thank you for permitting this painful clarification. I had hoped private measures would spare us all, but certain persons have chosen spectacle. Lady Beatrice smiled. My dear Augusta, you wound me. I chose spectacle with the greatest care. A few mouths tightened. Lady Augusta ignored her. Before any further confusion is encouraged, I must say plainly what charity and delicacy have too long concealed. The young woman before you is Mary Fenn, a dependent of my household. She has formed an attachment to the identity of the late Marianne Fairholt, whose keepsake she obtained improperly, and whose memory she now uses to advance herself. Marianne felt the accusation pass over her skin. It hurt. It did not knock her down. Sir Lionel stepped forward with the polished regret of a man presenting a bill. We possess written evidence of Miss Fenn's long-standing fixation, and an object which shows how easily sentiment may be manipulated. Octavia's hand moved toward her reticule. Lady Beatrice moved at the same moment, not toward Octavia, but just enough to stand in a line where she could see the girl's fingers. The Countess noticed, her eyes narrowed. Sebastian remained beside Marianne, silent as promised. That silence was not absence. It was a wall held in reserve. Lady Augusta looked at him, perhaps expecting interruption, then looked back at Marianne when none came. The small failure irritated her. Mary, she said softly, even now if you confess the mistake, there may be mercy. Marianne heard Sir Lionel's threat in that word, the paper she had torn, the identity they had tried to make her sign. She slipped one gloved hand over the locket at her throat and felt the crack beneath her palm. Mercy seems to be a word you use when you mean obedience. Lady Augusta's nostrils flared. Octavia gave a small, nervous laugh. You see, she has been coached. Sebastian's hand remained at his side. He did not move. Marianne drew strength from that more than from any defense. Lady Augusta's voice cooled. Then let us end this. There stands the impostor. The room fell so quiet that even the candles seemed to hold their breath. For one suspended moment after Lady Augusta spoke, Marianne heard nothing but the thin hiss of candle flames and the old beating of fear in her own blood. There stands the impostor. The word should have sent her back into the narrow room near the attic stair. Back beneath all the names she had been ordered to answer. Instead, it found her standing in Countess of Evershult's drawing room, with the cracked ivory locket against her breast, Mrs. Wren behind her, Lady Beatrice at her side, Sebastian silent beside her, because he had promised to let her speak. Marianne looked at Lady Augusta and felt, not confidence, not peace, but a stillness more useful than either. No, she said. The word was not loud. It carried because no one breathed over it. I am not. Lady Augusta's mouth tightened. Denial is not proof. Then let us have proof, Marianne answered. All of it. Octavia stepped forward too quickly. Gladly, her hand flew into her reticule, and she drew out a small oval locket of pale ivory, holding it high enough for the nearest guests to see. This is the keepsake Mary stole and used for her little performance. My aunt kept it among old Fairholt effects for years. Lady Beatrice moved with the speed of a woman who had spent decades making people regret underestimating her. Her cane touched the edge of Octavia's wrist, not hard, only precise enough to stop the movement. How fascinating, she said. The young lady produces a locket before Miss Fairholt has opened hers. The Countess of Evershult's eyes narrowed. Miss Kersey. Bring it here, Octavia hesitated. That hesitation did more harm than refusal. Sir Sebastian's gaze fixed on the object, cold and exact. Miss Kersey, he said. You heard the Countess? Octavia crossed the carpet and placed the locket on the table, as if it had burned her fingers. Mr. Penrose stepped forward, opened his leather folio, and bowed to the Countess. With your permission, my lady. You have it. He examined Octavia's locket, without touching Marianne's, recent hinge, newer chain. The ivory has been darkened, but not by time. The engraving inside, if I may, he opened it. Marianne Fairholt, a murmur passed through the room. Sir Lionel seized on it. There, the name appears. Objects can be copied, stories confused, and servants persuaded. Indeed, Mr. Penrose said dryly. Objects can be copied, badly. Sebastian did not smile, but Lady Beatrice did. Marianne reached for the locket at her throat. Her fingers trembled once, she allowed them to. Then she unfastened the chain and laid the cracked ivory locket beside the false one. The difference was plain even before Mr. Penrose leaned nearer. Hers was worn thin, where a child's fingers might have held it for years. The crack crossed the painted violets in an old, dark line. The inner hinge had been mended clumsily, more than once. "This," Marianne said, "was with me before I knew how to spell the name inside it. I was told it was vanity. I was told it belonged to a dead child. I was told I had stolen affection from a grave." She opened it. The lock of dark baby hair rested beneath the engraved name. But someone remembered it. Mrs. Wren came forward, small among the silks, her face pale with feeling and firm with truth. "I remember tying a violet ribbon through that chain on the day Miss Marianne Fairholt was baptized. Her mother laughed because the child tried to put the ribbon in her mouth. I remember the crack, too. It came later, when Lady Celia dropped it upon the nursery tiles during the fever. She cried over that silly crack because she thought the child might not live to wear it again." Lady Augusta's fan opened. "A nurse's sentiment proves nothing. Age confuses grief." Mrs. Wren turned on her. "Grief never confused me as much as your letter telling me the child was dead when she was not." A sound broke from the room. Soft and shocked, Sir Lionel spoke quickly. "This is improper. A servant repeats memory, and suddenly we are to undo 12 years of accepted truth." "Not memory alone," Mr. Toller said. The vicar's voice shook. But he stepped forward with the courage of a man who had decided shame would be worse than fear. "The parish register for the year of Miss Marianne's baptism has been cut. The missing portion corresponds to the lower entries of that month. Earlier today, a groom connected to Kersey House approached me, asking whether loose pages from old registers might be purchased for a family archive." Lady Augusta's face was white now. Hearsay. Lady Beatrice's cane struck the carpet. A convenient word, Augusta. It has carried many liars across thin ice. Mr. Penrose opened another paper. "There is also the matter of the Fairholt Trust. Mr. Alaric Fairholt left a portion of his estate and funds to be held for his only child. After her supposed death, administration passed through connections tied to the late Mr. Kersey, and later to Sir Lionel Craik in advisory capacity. If the child lived, any concealment of her existence would be a grave breach of duty." Sir Lionel's polished calm cracked. "I acted upon information supplied by Lady Augusta." Lady Augusta turned slowly. "Lionel, I will not be ruined for your sentimental mismanagement of an inconvenient girl," he snapped. Then remembered the room too late. The words landed exactly where truth had been waiting. Inconvenient girl. Not deluded servant, not mistaken dependent. Girl, alive, known. Octavia gasped. "Uncle Lionel, you said the papers were safe." The Countess looked at her. "What papers, Miss Kersey?" Octavia's lips parted, but Lady Augusta's command cut across the room. "Be silent." "No," Marianne said. Everyone turned. She had not raised her voice, but something in it had changed. She removed her glove from her left hand with careful fingers and turned her wrist outward. "Mrs. Wren remembered this scar," she said. "I received it as a child at Fairholt Grange." The old nurse nodded through tears. The nursery grate. She was rescuing a wooden horse. Marianne laid the violet ribbon beside the locket. She remembered the ribbon. "Mr. Toller remembers the damaged register. Mr. Penrose has the trust. Sir Lionel has named me inconvenient. Miss Kersey brought a false locket before I opened the real one." She looked at Lady Augusta then, fully without flinching. "You called me Mary because Marianne had money, memory, and a claim. Mary had only obedience." Lady Augusta's composure did not shatter. It thinned until everyone could see the fear behind it. "You ungrateful child." Sebastian moved at last, not in front of Marianne, but one pace nearer. His voice was quiet enough to be more dangerous than a shout. "You will not address Miss Fairholt in that manner again." The name crossed the room like a door opening. Miss Fairholt, not as hope. Not as private comfort. As public fact, spoken by the highest-ranking man present. Lady Augusta tried to answer, but the Countess of Evershult spoke first. "I believe we have heard enough to understand the shape of the matter. Mr. Penrose, you will provide me with copies of your findings. Mr. Toller, I shall ask for your written statement. Mrs. Wren, you have my respect." She turned to Marianne. Her curtsy was small, formal, and devastating. Miss Fairholt, I regret that my drawing room was used in an attempt to wound you. I am honored it may instead serve to hear you. The room shifted. Not warmly. Not yet. Society rarely repented with speed, but every face changed its calculation. One older lady, who had refused to meet Marianne's eyes at the subscription rooms, now lowered her head. A gentleman bowed. Another followed. Then the Countess said, clear enough for all, Miss Fairholt. The name repeated softly at the edges of the room, uncertain at first, then unavoidable. Marianne felt it move around her, not like applause, but like air returning to a sealed chamber. Lady Augusta stood rigid near the mantel. Sir Lionel looked toward the door, already measuring escape. Octavia clutched her empty reticule. All pink-cheeked terror now that cruelty had stopped being entertainment. Marianne picked up the cracked locket and fastened it again with steady hands. My name, she said. And this time she did not whisper, is Marianne Fairholt. No one corrected her, no one laughed, no one took the name away. Sebastian's eyes were on her. But he did not speak until the Countess dismissed the gathering into strained, fractured conversation, and Lady Augusta was surrounded by consequences she could no longer arrange into elegance. Only then, in the quieter passage outside the drawing room, did he walk beside Marianne rather than ahead of her. Now that your name is yours again, he asked, his voice low, who do you wish to become? Marianne looked down at the locket, at the crack that had survived concealment, rain, and lies. Then she looked back at the room where her silence had finally ended. Someone who never signs herself away again, she said. 3 weeks after London learned to say Miss Fairholt without stumbling. Marianne returned to Alderwick Park in a carriage that did not feel like rescue. That difference mattered more than the fine weather, more than the clean blue of the Hampshire sky, more even than the calling cards stacked in Lady Beatrice's lap, like evidence of society's sudden morality. The same drive that had once carried her half-conscious beneath Sebastian's cloak now opened before her in calm green curves. The hedgerows newly washed by morning rain, and the stone pillars, standing ahead with their carved Belmere crest above the gate. Marianne watched them approach without shrinking into the corner. She sat upright, gloved hands folded, the cracked ivory locket visible at her throat. No one had told her to wear it. No one had asked her to hide it. Lady Beatrice, seated opposite, sorted through the cards with an expression of wicked satisfaction. Mrs. Pemberton sends respect. Lady Havers sends remorse, though she spells it as curiosity. Lady Dunmere asks whether you might call next month, which means she has decided she believed you all along. Marianne looked at the little pile. She did not. Of course not. That is why the English invented manners. They allow cowardice to arrive dressed as hospitality. Mrs. Wren, who had come to Alderwick for a fortnight before returning to her cottage, gave a soft chuckle beside the window. Let them send their cards. Paper is lighter than apology. Marianne smiled, and the ease of it startled her. Smiles had once felt dangerous, as if joy were another form of presumption. Now joy came cautiously, but it came. Fairholt Grange had not yet been reopened, though Mr. Penrose had written that the estate books were being examined, the remaining trustees notified, and Sir Lionel Craik's advisory control suspended, pending formal review. Lady Augusta Kersey had withdrawn from Hampshire society under the phrase ill health, which fooled no one who mattered. Her invitations had stopped arriving, first from the Countess of Evershult, then from two ladies who had always disliked her, but required permission from rank to remember their principles. Octavia's part in the false locket had spread with the speed of a better scandal than the one she had attempted to create. And her mother had taken her to a cousin near York, where even pink ribbons could not restore innocence cheaply spent. None of it gave Marianne back the stolen years. Yet justice, she was learning, did not always mend what had been broken. Sometimes it simply stopped the hand that kept breaking it. The carriage halted before Alderwick Park. Harrow stood at the door with the entire front of the house behind him, polished, solemn, and ready. Marianne remembered being carried up those steps, unable to lift her head. She remembered fear lying over her like wet wool. Now she stepped down with Lady Beatrice's hand at her elbow, and found Sebastian waiting at the foot of the stairs. He did not stand above her. He stood on the gravel, hat in hand. The dark severity of him softened by something he no longer bothered to hide. "Miss Fairholt," he said. The name was formal, but his voice made it intimate. Marianne curtsied. Not because she was less than he, but because courtesy freely chosen had ceased to feel like surrender. "Your Grace," his gaze touched the locket, then returned to her face. "Welcome home." The words struck too deep for immediate reply. Alderwick was not hers by blood. Fairholt Grange stood elsewhere, waiting with stone falcons and old shadows. Yet this house had been the first place where her fear had been contradicted by action. It had held her name before the world would hold it. It had given her a room without requiring silence as rent. "Thank you," she said, "for bringing me back as myself." Lady Beatrice cleared her throat with theatrical impatience. "If everyone intends to speak beautifully on the steps, I shall perish of sentiment before luncheon." Sebastian's mouth moved almost into a smile. "We cannot have that." Harrow bowed as Marianne entered, and this time no servant stared at mud, ruin, or rumor. Mrs. Pym stood in the hall with suspicious brightness in her eyes, and made an unnecessary adjustment to a vase of flowers. Jenny, the maid who had once mistaken Marianne for another servant in the passage, curtsied so deeply that Marianne nearly reached out to prevent her from toppling. "Welcome, Miss Fairholt," Mrs. Pym said. The words passed through the hall like a bell rung softly. Marianne touched the locket once, then let her hand fall. She would not clutch it against the world today. After luncheon, Lady Beatrice announced that Mrs. Wren required rest. Mr. Penrose required a letter answered, and she herself required complete silence from Dukes for at least 1 hour. The arrangements were so transparent that Marianne almost laughed. Sebastian accepted the command with grave obedience and asked whether Marianne would walk with him to the morning room first. The room was smaller than the drawing room. Full of pale light and quiet furniture, with windows overlooking the east lawn where the grass shone after rain, a silver tray of tea waited untouched. On the table beside it lay no legal documents. No statements, no forged letters, no papers waiting to define her. Only a small blue velvet case. Marianne saw it and stopped. Sebastian noticed at once. "It is not what you fear," he said. "I don't fear it." Her voice was soft but true. "I only know that boxes have often held things I was not allowed to choose." He bowed his head. "Then you shall choose whether it is opened." For a moment they stood with the table between them, and Marianne felt the full strangeness of being asked instead of managed. "You may open it," she said. Sebastian lifted the lid. Inside was not a ring. It was a small new clasp, delicately made of gold, shaped to fit the old chain of the cracked ivory locket, without replacing it. "The locket's hinge is too fragile," he said. Mr. Penrose found a jeweler who could strengthen the chain without altering the ivory. "I thought you might wish it safe, but if the change feels wrong, it will not be made." Marianne touched the velvet edge of the case. The gift was not grand. It did not glitter for society. It did not attempt to improve the broken thing until its history disappeared. It only made survival easier to carry. "It does not feel wrong," she whispered. "It feels understood." His eyes darkened with feeling he held carefully, as he held everything precious. "That is what I wanted." Silence settled, warm and unthreatening. Then Sebastian closed the case and placed it aside, as if even tenderness should not be allowed to crowd the truth he had come to speak. "Marianne." It was the first time he had used her name without title when they were alone. She felt it, but did not step back. "Yes, I will not ask you because London has spoken. I will not ask because Fairholt Grange is being restored, or because Lady Augusta has fallen, or because scandal has turned its face elsewhere. I will not ask because you require protection. You do not." Her breath caught. He took no advantage of it. "I ask because, since the day I found you in the road, I have watched you claim yourself, piece by piece, from every hand that tried to keep you small. I admired your dignity before I knew your story. I trusted your courage before I knew your proof. I love the woman who refused to sign herself out of existence. Marianne's eyes filled. This time she did not forbid the tears. Sebastian, if you choose Fairholt Grange, I will see it restored, and never call that distance rejection. If you choose London, I will stand beside you there. If you choose a life that has no place for me, I will honor it, though I will not pretend it would not break my heart. He drew a breath, and for the first time she saw the Duke of Bellemere afraid. Not of society, not of scandal, of her answer. But if you can imagine a life in which Alderwick is home as well as Fairholt, in which my name stands beside yours, and never over it, then I ask you to marry me. Marianne looked toward the windows. Sunlight crossed the lawn in quiet bars. Somewhere in the house, Lady Beatrice was probably pretending not to listen. Somewhere beyond the hills, Fairholt Grange waited. Not as a prison of stolen memory, but as an inheritance she could enter when ready. She touched the locket, then lowered her hand deliberately. I spent many years thinking love would be another room where someone told me how to stand, she said. You have never asked me to be smaller so that you could seem kinder. His face changed, hope held still. Is that yes? She smiled through tears. It's yes. He did not seize her. He did not forget himself in triumph. He stepped closer and offered his hand, palm upward, as he had done when asking permission to stand beside her. Marianne placed her hand in his. Only then did he lift it and press his lips to her gloved fingers, with a reverence that made the simple gesture feel like a vow. Later, before the looking glass in the blue chamber, Marianne fastened the cracked ivory locket with its old chain and new clasp. The crack remained, the violets remained, the name inside remained. Sebastian stood behind her, reflected beside her but not crowding the glass. He did not touch her until she turned and offered him her hand. Outside, Alderwick Park lay bright after rain, and somewhere among the morning calls and restored papers and open roads ahead, Mary Fenn faded into the past without being despised. She had been the name of survival. Marianne Fairholt would be the name of choice, and when Sebastian's fingers closed gently around hers, she understood at last that home was not the place where no sorrow had ever entered. Home was the place where no one asked her to hide her name again.